Good morning, everyone. I'm sure I've got feedback on my iPad. Hopefully, it's not coming back to it all. Good morning. Welcome to the May 56th Wildlife Commission meeting. This is our first combination in-person and virtual meeting. So please bear with us. Please bear with us in terms of working through technical difficulties. I'm going to try to move that iPad away because I think I'm feedbacking all of you. Thanks for this opportunity to be in Grand Junction, and it is incredible to finally meet again in person, although we're following very strict COVID protocols in order to accommodate the ability to meet in person as well as follow our safety procedures. So thank you very much. Let's start with the Pledge of Allegiance, and as we're all here together, and I'd ask that my buddies here, Chris Hauser, to lead us in that pledge.
With liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. With that, I'll begin by going to agenda item number two, which is the minutes of the March 17th and 18th meeting and approval of those minutes. First, I'll call for any corrections or modifications to those minutes.
Yes, hello. This is Commissioner Adams. I'm joining. Did I miss the roll call?
Oops. I'm sorry.
You're not all there in person. I'm joining remotely, as I am not fully vaccinated, and I just wanted to make sure that I did not miss roll call.
Well, no, you didn't, but I missed the roll call.
Oh, no problem, no problem.
So, Laura, could you execute the roll call for me, please?
Yes. Adam.
Present.
Micah. Present. Garcia.
Present.
Haskett.
Present.
Hauser.
Present.
Present. Here.
Schaefer.
Here.
Hutchton.
Present.
Barty.
Present.
Sherman.
Present.
All present.
Thank you, Commissioner Adams, for putting me back on track. And with that, I'll step forward to agenda item two with regards to the approval of the minutes. Again, calling for any corrections or modifications to those minutes. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes as written for the March 17, 18, 2021 Virtual Parks and Wildlife Commission meeting.
So moved.
Commissioner Barty, second. Second by Commissioner Haskett. That was put in motion by Commissioner Tushton. All right, let's move on to agenda item number three, which is the consent agenda. I'd ask for any corrections or removals, if needed, from the consent agenda topic, which we discussed later. I'm way off track. This is what happens when you move to an in-person meeting versus virtual. You get completely confused. Now that we have a motion and a second to approve the minutes, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Same sign. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Laura. Now I'll move forward to agenda item three, which is the consent agenda. Any corrections or removals from the consent agenda?
I've raised my good morning. This is Commissioner Adams. Commissioner, Chairman McDaniels, we may want to have somebody monitor the chat, the Zoom, so that you can be alerted when we raise our hands for those of us who are not in person. But I would like to remove two items from the consent agenda. The first is 21-12, I believe, which is and again, I may have the numbers wrong, so I apologize, but essentially it is the conflict of interest item. I'd like to pull that off of the consent agenda and have a discussion around that. And I'd also like to remove item 2111, the real estate agenda item. Thank you.
Any other requests for removal to the consent agenda?
I can't hear. Commissioners who are virtual.
It's very difficult. I'm going to ask Jake to speak to that.
Good thing. So I heard Commissioner Adams remove the conflicts of interest policy, which is on the consent agenda item as 2112, and all of 2111, which is the real estate consent agenda, which consists of items A through H. And my question was whether it was the entirety of the real estate items or anything in particular.
The entirety of the items, Jake. Thank you so much for the clarification, and I appreciate the I will try and speak more clearly and loudly.
I can't hear you.
So the what we're experiencing here is we have one small speaker system on here, but we have a larger PA system, and the next time we do this, we'll have a second system connected to this one. Can we use this?
Yeah.
Can I go ahead and do that?
Can I ask the public to pause here? We're going to try to figure out a couple
technological difficulties.
We can improve the quality of our broadcast.
All right. Commissioner Adams, could you speak for a second, see if we can hear you now.
I'm happy to speak. This is Commissioner Adams. My mic sounds nice. Check one.
We'll try that. It's the best we can do.
Could I ask you, Commissioner Adams or Commissioner Schaefer, one of you speak to see if we can hear you clearly throughout the room?
Yeah. How about
sorry,
this?
Oh, I hear you very well, Luke.
Better?
Can you all hear me on your end?
Kind of.
I will try to project. I don't know if the three of us will be able to get much louder than what we are, though.
We just did a little moving of the mic, Luke, so I think we're now able to hear you pretty clearly. So, okay, let me get back to the consent agenda. Take matter. I think we clarified the removal of the entire request for removal of the entire item 21-11, as well as item 21-12 or about 12. Is that correct?
Correct.
Any other requests with regards to the consent agenda? Those items will be removed and discussed separately prior to any voting on the consent agenda later on within our meeting. Okay, so with that, I will turn it over to item number four, which is commissioners' questions in our open discussion period and comments, and I'd open the floor to any commissioner who would like to give an update.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a couple minutes, please.
Commissioner May.
I'd like to use a couple minutes to give some recognition to some of CPW staff that I think doesn't get enough. In our region, there are several staff leaders that do a lot of work outside of their normal ramp of duties. And that is in one of the small things, planting trees and shelter belts all over Southeast Colorado. I've had the pleasure of working with them some lately, but those are the two people I work with are Kevin Kazmarek and Jonathan Wrights. And over the past 22 years, they have planted miles and miles of trees in southeast Colorado for animal shelter, for wildlife habitat, for anything that those benefits come from. I'll just read right quickly. CPW and the Lamar Pheasants Forever chapter planted over 11,000 linear feet of shrubs this year on 8 project sites in Broward County. Most of those projects were on private property, putting in shelter belts for quail, pheasants, and deer. One of the projects was a wetland restoration project planting cottonwood and willow in an area where timber control had previously been conducted. Primary funding for these sources are Powers County projects came from CPW Wetlands Grant and the Lamar Pheasant River Chapter. This was Kevin Kazmarek as the lead on this. In Bath County, CPW staff and volunteers installed over 55,000 linear feet of shrub groves in 19 project sites in Bath County. Most of those sites were in grazing enclosures on the Comanche National Grasslands. And this was done with funding from Bath County auction raffle grant dollars, and this was Jonathan Rice's project. But I just wanted to bring your attention to them because they all do often don't get it. The machines that you see in the pictures, one of those was built by Kevin in 1999. And I would estimate, he was humbling when I'm telling you this, but they planted over 50 miles of trees in southeast Colorado. And in many places, you can look for miles on the horizon, and those are the only trees and shrubs and wildlife habitat that you see. So I wanted to take this time to give them some credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner May. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you. Dallas and I did not set this up, but I had something similar to thank some folks and some organizations that I've been working with. There was someone, these are my slides. So the outfit that's my day job, Southern Plains Land Trust, we received a grant from the Colorado Water Conservation Board to work with volunteers for Outdoor Colorado, that's their camp there, on a repair and restoration project in the Arkansas watershed. And you can advance the slide. Building what's commonly called one rock dams. Some people call them Z dike structures after the fellow who pioneered this idea. But they're just small human scale projects designed to slow down water, to reduce its erosion power, get it to go into the soil, and drop its sediment load. So go ahead and advance the slide again. These are about 40 people, primarily from Denver and Boulder, that came down to Bend County to work on these things. There's one finished. Go ahead, one more slide. Here's our Dallas district. That's Jonathan Reeds. So after a day of these volunteers moving rocks for me, Jonathan came out and taught him how to plant sumac. And this is a Sunday, so he's definitely doing this on his own time. He brought his wildlife tech Eric and his intern Skyler. And go ahead and do another slide. And we planted all together about 400 of these sumacs. What this project, I think, though, represents is we're not just planting sumac or growing sumac for wildlife, but we're also trying to grow people who care about growing sumac for wildlife. So half the benefit is the sumac are in the ground. The other half is that 40 people from the Front Range gave up a week to come and care about all that. Go on, first slide, please. This is a little different project. I wanted to make some folks aware of a resource. That's just a picture of a derelict fence. I've already taken the wire off. It's just a post, so that's the before picture. Go one more slide. These are a crew of folks from Fort Lyon, which is an institution run by the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless in near Los Angeles. They're formerly homeless people who are housed there, possibly recovering from substance abuse, 250 of them, and they are really excited to go out and do something as boring as roll barbed wire all day. So they're actually a very significant resource And I view it as a way to, you know, give people an opportunity to help heal themselves while healing nature. We're ripping down this fence to benefit Pronghorn. We didn't need the fence. Go one last slide and move on. There it's been, it's gone. These are just simple, so not that great, but the Pronghorn will appreciate that, and I think those guys from Fort Lyon appreciate getting out, but at least in the southeast region, there's a workforce of about 250 folks out there that would love to get out of that VA hospital and do something out of the prayer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Touchton. Commissioner Haskin.
Thank you, Chairman McDaniel, and it's wonderful to see you in person again. I just want to recognize Commissioner May, actually, who recently received the Colorado Leopold Conservation Award. I don't know if anybody's aware of that, but I'll be there.
Thank you. Commissioner Hauser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We may have a chance to do this later, but I just publicly on mic want to congratulate Emily Organic on her transition. Our loss is Western Colorado Community Foundation's gain. So hopefully we'll have a chance later to celebrate in some way with elbow bumps and otherwise, but I think we all know how much Emily has brought to our organization and the liaison role with Great Outdoors Colorado. So personally, I wish Emily the best and congratulate her, and certainly would also on behalf of Commission. So congratulations.
Thank you, Commissioner Hauser. Any other updates? I'm looking around and folks down the line here, Commissioner.
Sorry,
I can't see
Commissioner Adams
on the left hand side, but start with was that you, Commissioner Adams?
It is, and again, I want to ask for some staff support for Commissioner for our chair, so that we can better catch the things that are coming as hands are raised in the chat box, so that we can, that would be really helpful. Laura, I noticed I don't have capacity to share my screen. Oh, just kidding. Thank you. So I will be very brief as well. I know we have a lot of agenda items. I hope that you can hear me okay. I am raising my voice a little bit more than usual. Again, I want to thank the incredible leadership of Raquel and her team at the Colorado Natural Areas Council, which is a component of Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And we are excited to share that the field season is well underway. As you may recall, the CNAP program monitors our state's most unique natural features, including rare plants, plant communities, wildlife, fossils, and geologic features. Our staff monitors these rare plants and is really leaders around that rare plant conservation effort. I'm noticing some sound. Is there something I can do, or... or can we put some folks on? Thank you. And then we also wanted to highlight the incredible volunteer steward program, and wanted to thank the incredible efforts of the volunteers, that many of whom have over half have served for over 10 years. These volunteers conduct important scientific studies and collect data useful for land managers. We are eager to not only continue to build and grow our volunteers, but also to diversify in all of the ways, not only racially and ethnically, but also geographically, at the age spectrum, education levels. And so if you'd like to know more about this incredible program, we will please reach out to me directly, or, of course, the leadership under Raquel's leadership. I'm excited to do a visit later this month, and invited some leadership from Outdoor Afro, Latinos Outdoors, Outdoor Asians, and others. And so, again, it's about building those ongoing, meaningful relationships and touch points. And I invite and I want to thank both Raquel, and I want to take a moment of appreciation for Fletcher, who runs our state trail program, who also has been engaging these various affiliate organization, outdoor organizations to not only provide volunteer opportunities, but also to share the rich and meaningful work of Colorado Parks and Wildlife and meaningful ways for them to engage. So again, want to thank all Colorado Parks and Wildlife staff who are continuously engaging, you know, organizations like Outdoor Afro, Latinos Outdoors Colorado, Outdoor Asians Colorado, Native Women's Wilderness, and Vibe Tribe Colorado, and of course, Girls Trek. I know I've shown this map before, but I'm just so excited about it. I'm just going to keep putting it on there. I know folks will have access to this presentation after this session, so feel free to go in there. It really helped me to really put a visual on all of these different protected areas. Speaking of engagement, I had the opportunity to serve on a panel hosted by Western Resource Advocates on exploring an orientation on boards and commissions. And there I learned that there were over 300 boards and commissions in Colorado that folks can be a part of. And it was an honor to serve on that with Commissioner Kate Greensburg, who leads our incredible work at the Colorado Department of Agriculture. And so to be able to not only engage public around these meaningful engagement opportunities, but also to share some of the common pitfalls, some of the barriers, as well as the things that we gain from these experiences, like leadership, you know, community, et cetera. One of the other things that was an unexpected outcome was the opportunity to, as a commissioner for Colorado Parks and Wildlife, to communicate and get to know some of the other commissioners and board members from the other commissions that we intersect with. And so to have Commissioner Greensburg attend our CPW meetings, I feel like I have a great understanding of what's happening in our Department of Ag. But to have Vice President of the Denver Board of Water Commissioners, Craig Jones, there was incredible, as well as Sarah Palmer, who chairs Colorado Conservation Easement Oversight Commission. So again, I urge our Department of Natural Resources to continue to find ways to engage not only the public on how they can step into these roles that are so critical, but also how can we better create opportunities for us as board and commissioners to come together to get to know each other and our respective work, which again touches, right? The decisions that are made at the water board, that's going to impact the policies that we set here at CPW. So again, I wanted to offer that as a recommendation, as an opportunity, but also just appreciation to Western Resource Advocates for their leadership in helping to demystify what it means to be on a board and a commission and to serve, civically engage in this way. And then lastly, I would be remiss if I did not mention that May 5th is the National Day of Awareness and Action for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Children, and Gender Diverse Peoples. On this day, we aim to raise awareness about this ongoing crisis and to take action. And so I've provided a couple of different resources. Unfortunately, we will be on the Zoom call during an awareness session. It will be recorded, so I urge you to email and reach out directly to the Women's Center Calgary, who is hosting that. Also in the photo below, you will see members of the Native Women's Wilderness here in Colorado. And I urge Colorado Parks and Wildlife to engage with this organization to learn more about ways that we, what kind of actions that we can take as it relates to our state parks, as it relates to our wildlife areas, to ensure that Indigenous women, children, and gender diverse peoples are not taken or murdered on our watch. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Adams. Commissioner Garcia?
Thank you, Chair. So along with Commissioner Hauser's congratulations to Emily, it's a great loss for GoCo, but a great gain for Grand Junction. So she's back home. Welcome back to Grand Junction. And sitting next to her, maybe many of you just don't remember, a young lady by the name of Adrienne Varney. Welcome back to CPW, Adrienne Varney. So quickly, did all of the standard sportsman's roundtables, legislative caucus, and I want to thank Reed for the work that he did on the first Wolf reintroduction Zoom program that we had the other night. I thought it was fantastic. Really, a round of applause. I just think that's not right. The other one was the Colorado Outdoors. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do that like we're doing here, and we had to do that on Zoom. And it's a long-range project, but it got started. And the first two presenters that they did on Zoom were Eduardo Garcia. He was great, so he must be related. And then the other fellow was Drew Lanham, and another great, great presentation. So thank you for the people that were involved in that. It was a great start to the Colorado Partners Outdoors, and I look forward to, I think we've got another one coming up next week. So a whole series. So true. You know, the great thing about the pandemic, other than Commissioner Tushton doesn't get haircuts, and I get the worst haircuts in the whole world. But other than that, the great thing about the pandemic is all of these great Zoom programs that we've been able to watch. There was one, CPW's been doing a bunch. There was one recently called Emblems of the West. I don't know how many of you saw it, but it was a fantastic video. So I shot an email up to Jeff to be able to try and thank the people that were involved. And I got this email. It's a little lengthy, but I'm going to run through it. Charlie, certainly Sean Ender, Peak to Creek Films. Within CPW, it would be mammals researchers Nathaniel, I think it's Rail, and Eric Bergman. A few staff provided very constructive feedback during editing, including Lauren Truitt. Jason Clay gave it a huge push at the end to get it online. The video was filmed mostly in Area 8, but the research is also occurring in Area 10. The people in those areas had a huge investment in this research, and they were great to work with. If we included everyone who lent a hand with research projects like this, it would be a list of 30 to 40 people. Just shows you how much the CPW family supports each other. And I think that said it all. When I got that email from Jeff, I said, yeah, that's what it's about. It's the CPW family. And so to the CPW family, for that film and all the other ones, there was one I just watched the other night on the links reintroduction. And incredible. So during the pandemic, you know, you don't have to watch Fargo and Ozarks. You know, there's actually some really good educational stuff that we could all be watching. And so the only other thing I have is during this pandemic, in addition to watching all this, I've been reading, and I was able to get the director, Prinslow, to add to our library at CPW. And I got these, and I brought them along, and any commissioner who would like to have them, we can start spreading them around. The first is the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. I think it's a really nice sort of look at what we talk about constantly at these meetings, which is the North American Model. Second one is Thinking Like a Manager, Reflections on Wildlife Management. Another one that has a really good insight into the North American Model. And then finally, Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement. Great books, and you're welcome to take these as long as you return them to Director Prinslow at some point or share them with other commissioners. And then finally, this one I bought after the presentation on Partners Outdoors from Drew Lana. His most recent book is called Sparrow Envy, and it's poetry. So if you're into poetry, it's really a fun read, and it's mine, but you are welcome to take it today and pass it along to others. So thank you all.
Thank you, Commissioner Garcia. I'd also like to ask you about the significance of the duck call that's hanging off your COVID screen.
So this is a duck call that has my new puppy's name. I promised I wouldn't bring pictures of my puppy anymore. I brought my puppy in, and so I could bring the puppy in, but that would be a problem. But this is a duck call that I had made that actually has my dog, Ladybug, name engraved on the duck call, and it's made out of Osage orange, which Jeff and Reed will tell you is an extremely important wood, and it's used for one thing, in making boats for our archer people. So that's what it's there for.
I thought you were going to give us a lesson later. Anyway, thank you very much, Commissioner Garcia. Again, I apologize that, you know, we're trying to sort through this virtual / in-person meeting. A little rocky start by me. For the commissioners on the screen, I wanted to ask that you use the raise hand feature on Zoom, because when there's material displayed on the screen in front of us that we can see here in the room, we can't see that you're raising your hand to speak. So, but I do have you dialed in on my desk in front of me on the Zoom call, so I can pick you up there, and I'm trying to balance that between watching this as well as looking down the line. And again, a reminder for the commissioners that are at the end of the table here, I can't really see you. So, you know, shout out or wave your hand if you need to speak. Okay, let's move forward and have DNR Executive Director Dan Gibbs give his update as part of agenda item number 5. Welcome, Mr. Gibbs.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you all hear me all right? Okay, great. First of all, absolutely wonderful, wonderful, wonderful to see you all in person, CPW staff that are here. This is our first board and commission meeting for the Department of Natural Resources and in person, and this may be the first in the state. As many of you know, June 1st is really the time frame that many more kind of state functions are starting to open up with more people coming to the office and so forth. It's really a phased approach. So for folks that are not here in person, that are participating via Zoom or, you know, Facebook or other different venues that you can view this, it's really quite amazing to see how we've set this up to make sure there's safety for the commissioners, the public, each folks have more or less plastic guards around us that help keep everything contained in your own space, and really looks like an amazing model. So Director Prinsloo, you and your staff for setting this up to have a safe model. This is I'm just really excited, and I think we can do this safely, and it's really wonderful to see you all in person. It's been a long time. It's been over a year. And so for the folks that are on Zoom, I look forward to seeing you hopefully, you know, next meeting. I know folks are still getting their shots, and some folks have had one and some folks have had two and so forth. So there's that process going on, and we want to make sure that we're able to have this meeting and make sure it's safe for staff, the public, commissioners, everyone involved. And this will be a phased approach. So this will be a hybrid meeting. So I know it may be a little clunky, you know, today and tomorrow, but I urge everyone's patience for this, just because this is our first meeting that we're trying to do in, as much as possible in person. So with that, a few other updates. We are really busy, to say the least, with the legislative session in full swing. Want to give you an update on some of our high priority bills that we're working on for the Department of Natural Resources. Number one is the Keep Colorado Wild Pass. I know you've been all briefed on this. This will be heard in the first committee, for the Senate Ag Committee tomorrow. I know some of you are going to be participating in that. So thank you for your support for that. This is really a game-changing bill that it's similar in some ways, where Future Generation Act was really focused on wildlife. This is really focused more so on our needs for our parks, but also has really important wildlife components, has really important equity, diversity, inclusion components, has really important funding components for our search and rescue needs, for Avalanche Information Center, for outdoor regional partnerships as well that we are working to have throughout the state. So really exciting for that particular, you know, proposal. We also tomorrow in the Senate Ag Committee have the search and rescue bill that authorizes Parks and Wildlife to conduct a study to develop recommendations on issues related to backcountry search and rescue. And that is also really important. As you all know, Parks and Wildlife is really involved with search and rescue all the time. We are a very important partner with search and rescue teams and county sheriffs around the state. Special shout out to Heather Dugan for all of your amazing leadership on this issue. I know you're going to be down at the Capitol when I'm down there tomorrow. So thank you so much for working so hard on this. Other bills that I want to share with you too, we have our Senate Bill 258. It's a wildfire risk mitigation bill that deploys up to $25 million of state stimulus funding. And I'm going to talk a little bit about more about the dynamics of that bill in a second. But we also have Senate Bill 237. That is our Forest Health Advisory Council that currently is housed within the Colorado State Forest Service. So many folks don't realize we do have a Division of Forestry, but it's really run through the Colorado State Forest Service. And so this has been a very important advisory board for our state forester, Mike Lester. But what we're doing is we're moving this advisory board to be within the Department of Natural Resources. So it's not only an advisor to the state forester, but also to the governor and to the legislators to make policy recommendations that we need in Colorado. We also have a water plan funding bill that's moving forward that has $20 million associated with that. There's $15 million for water plan implementation, and then $5 million for our Basin Roundtable for funding for that. We also have a big priority bill, HB 1226. That's our check stations for aquatic nuisance species. We really want to have parks and wildlife involved with making sure that, you know, boats that come from out of state are not bringing aquatic nuisance species into the state. That is very problematic, to say the least. So excited about that bill as well. And then big picture, I want to go back to this Senate Bill 258. You know, in the Department of Natural Resources, there are a lot of challenges that could exist. You know, there could be you name it, for catastrophic situations that we could be involved with. Division of Water Resources could be involved with, you know, a dam failure, oil and gas explosions, you name it. There's a lot of challenges. But one issue that really keeps me up at night are the wildfire seasons, you know, right around the corner. And so what we're doing right now is we're really looking at what we do right now for mitigation, and we're trying to put that on steroids. So I want to tell you what we're doing for the state of Colorado. So last week, the governor sent a letter to Secretary Vilsack of Department of Agriculture and Secretary Howland from Department of Interior, and that was signed by our two U.S. Senators, Hickenlooper and Bennett, as well as most of the Colorado delegation. It was a bipartisan letter. You had, you know, more conservative Congressman Lamborn from Colorado Springs, more liberal Congresswoman Dinah DeGette from Denver. So you get the picture. It was bipartisan, which was great. And this had a request to bring in a Type 1 NEMO team, a National Incident Management Organization. So these are the best of the best, the if you will, the Navy SEALs of kind of like dealing with major incidents, to come to Colorado to do a huge threat analysis to figure out where the most critical locations in the state are. And then once we have that mapping, then we're going to boost up capacity. So how are we doing that? Well, we're working, first of all, with our Department of Corrections. We're going to try to boost up the corrections crews to do mitigation work by about 160. We're working on that right now to have folks that are on the ground doing, you know, thing work. We're also boosting up our conservation corps, especially our youth corps around the state. And then we are working with we're going to have a fund of about $8.8 million that we're going to be able to divvy out to, you know, private contractors to do larger scale landscape scale treatment areas. I feel very strongly that we need to identify, you know, the top 25 or top 50 like fire breaks around the state that would be critical to protect human life, property, and critical infrastructure. And then also we're boosting up on the Colorado State Forest Service side our Healthy Forest Vibrant Communities Fund. That is a fund that the State Forest Service uses to help work with local communities to develop community wildfire protection plans and really help with private landowners to get projects off the ground. And then we also have a component of $2.5 million for the Forest Business Loan Program. It's very expensive for the equipment involved with forestry. You know, harvester can usually cost half a million dollars. You know, skid steer and you know, it's not just buying chainsaws. There's some heavy duty equipment that's very, very expensive. So we want to support, you know, the timber industry as well, because they're going to be an important partner as we look at what projects we need to get off the ground. So again, I'm really excited about that. Couple other updates. Water Conservation Board, we're continuing to work around the state on our demand management workshops. We've had 4 of those meetings completed. We have 12 to go before the end of June. Water Conservation Board also has, on May 18th, we'll have our first Water Equity Task Force, and they are charged with creating a better understanding of existing equity, diversity, and inclusion challenges in water issues to inform the Colorado Water Plan. Let's see, we also have our Colorado Geographic Naming Board that's housed within the Department of Natural Resources, and they just approved their bylaws and process on how they contemplate renaming physical features around the state. And this is an advisory board to the governor, and the governor will then make recommendations to the U.S. Board of Geographic Names. Let's see, I know I have a lot of information. I'm almost done. We also have our, I'm on the Colorado Commission on Indian Affairs Board. So we recently had a consultation agreement with the tribes regarding the Wilson Mesa stewardship parcel, which is in San Miguel County. That was our first meeting. We'll have another one soon. And also on May 28th, we will have a consultation working group with Utah and Southern Ute regarding wolves and the process of implementing Proposition 114. Another department, the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, had a heck of a crazy, challenging year this year. A lot of avalanche activities. Just to give you a quick snapshot, October to April in Colorado, we had 4,900 avalanches recorded, 879 human-triggered avalanches, 92 people caught, 4 deaths. It has been challenging year, and Colorado Avalanche Information Center was really working really hard to provide the best available information to backcountry snowmobilers, skiers, and so forth. And I know that many of you with Parks and Wildlife were partners in many of the search and rescue activities as it related to avalanches. Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, they're in the process of the financial assurance rulemaking. And so that's part of the step of implementing Senate Bill 181. So they have meetings weekly on that. Let's see, our Mine Land Reclamation Board met last week. They denied a permit by Peak Materials in Summit County. Very high octane, controversial vote on whether or not you have a rock crushing, rock aggregate mine just north of Silverthorn. It's really interesting. I actually thought the board was going to vote unanimously in support of it, but they ended up voting unanimously in opposition. But, you never know how things shake out. So I was a little surprised at that. And then, let's see here. And then State Land Board at their last meeting voted to approve the expansion of the public access program, bringing total enrollment to nearly 1 million acres to help fulfill the governor's, wildly important goal on increasing public access. I know we have a final vote on that, I believe, later on today. So that's been really important. And then also, last but not least, I want to just recognize a couple CPW retirements, 2 very significant retirements from Parks and Wildlife. First, we have Colorado State Park Manager Scott Elder in early May, and also Southwest Regionals Joe Lewandowski retired at the end of April. Scott started working for Chatfield State Park when he was 16 and continued through college and beyond, finishing his career as a manager at Mecos State Park and Lone Mesa. And then also after 16 years, 1,000 press releases, some 3,000 media contacts, interviews, hundreds of Twitter posts, 20 Colorado outdoor stories, 50 car trips around all over the place in the Great Southwest. Joe Lewandowski, the region's PIO, retired April 30th. So on behalf of the great state of Colorado and the Department of Natural Resources, I really want to express my gratitude to those 2 individuals for their amazing commitment to the state of Colorado. So let's give them a round of applause. And then last but not least, I also want to add my thank you. I know Emily's on the list to come up here shortly, but Emily Urbanek is, you know, it's, I believe it's been about 7 years she has been in this capacity of working with GOCO, but playing a really important role with Parks and Wildlife. So thank you so much, Emily, for your amazing service, and Western Colorado Community Foundation. They are going to be very, very lucky to have you. I know you're excited to get back to your roots here in the Western Slope. And with Adrian, we look forward to working with you, too, of course, in this new capacity. But congratulations, Emily, on this great new endeavor for you and your husband. Yeah, let's get over to the next one. I apologize, it's kind of long, but there's just a lot going on with the DNR, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I'll be here all day, too, if there are any, you know, side conversations or any follow-up that I could have tomorrow. I have to be at the Capitol, so thanks.
Thank you. Executive Director Gibbs, any questions?
I have my hand up in the...
Commissioner Adams?
Yes, hello. Thank you so much, Director Gibbs, for that incredible update. A couple of things. One, just, you know, it was incredible to hear just the efforts around, obviously, the, you know, drought and fire and all of the, you know, vendors and support that the different legislation is coming and hopefully funds to support. But my ears perked up when you said vendors. And I was reminded that Justin Rutter, our finance director, or sorry if I got that title wrong, director in my heart of finance, at one of our previous meetings said that our vendor contracts for the state, only 6 or 8% go to non-white owned businesses. And so just curious, as I know both the governor and DNR is addressing some of these inequities as it relates to, you know, accessing these opportunities to store these incredible lands that we have here. So just here, we'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, how this legislation and these activities could potentially help to address the inequitable distribution of government contracts racially and ethically. And then the second, through my work with Outdoor Afro as their policy director, I've been doing work in other states. And one state that comes to mind is California. And they are really underway with their 30 by 30 planning. They've already started their regional stakeholder meetings. I had an opportunity to participate in two of those meetings, and I'm actually going to be meeting with the state to talk about, debrief some of the things that I saw and opportunities to continue to engage. But just curious, I heard a lot in that update, and just curious how 30 by 30 and any updates that are available at this point. I know that Western Resource Advocates and Conservation Colorado developed that pathways. Colorado Pathways to 30 by 30, but I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything. So question one on the vendors, and then question two on any updates you may have as it relates to Colorado's response to 30 by 30.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Commissioner Adams, yeah, great questions. And let me maybe start with a 30 by 30. And just so everyone knows, that's an initiative to protect 30% of our lands by 2030. And I actually have a meeting later on today with leadership from Department of Interior, kind of DC staff regarding that. And it's definitely a priority by the President Biden administration. I would say for the Polis administration, we're definitely taking a very close look at that. We're making some recommendations on what we think we can do in Colorado. However, we do have a lot of questions. And so, for example, what constitutes really protecting of public lands? Certain water rights, is water part of that? Are state parks part of that? Are conservation easements part of that? So there's a lot of unknowns, and a lot of the folks I talk to, they say, well, you know, have Colorado come up with their own plan. Everyone's going to do things a little bit differently. I look at this very similar to how Colorado has a what's called a shared stewardship memorandum of understanding with the Department of Agriculture. So when I talked to Wade Crowfoot, the head of the DNR for California, his share of stewardship MOU that he has with the Department of Agriculture and the state of California is very different than ours. And likewise, you know, some states are very much focused on how many board feet of timber activity you have. Our particular agreement is focused on everything from diversity in the outdoors to parking and congestion on our public lands to looking at the right scale, right locations for forest health projects. So we are really trying to figure out a Colorado plan for what 30 by 30 would potentially look like. And also, we have a working group, too, with our agency partners. So Department of Agriculture, for example, is a very important partner with contemplating what a 30 by 30 would look like. CDPHE, you know, just like, you know, all of our different, you know, partners, it's not just the DNR, it's not just Colorado Parks and Wildlife, but it's, you know, we all very diverse agencies, and we need to, you know, work to collaborate on what that would look like, you know, moving forward. But we have some questions for the folks that are really pushing us to see what's in, what's outside the box, more or less.
Right.
So, well, we're working on it, if that answers your question.
Oh, I know you are. Right. I have no doubts. Right. But more so, again, in the California example, and why I bring it up is it appears that they're using it as an opportunity to kind of strengthen their stakeholder engagement processes overall. And I know I've raised this issue a couple of times. I'm really looking for something to anchor all of the different stakeholder engagements that happen throughout not only our agency and your department, but all of the departments throughout the state, right? And so, you know, I was particularly struck by their interest in learning, you know, how does the public define conservation? What does it mean to preserve, right? Just getting people's, you know, providing us, the public, with an opportunity to meaningfully engage on this as well and not wait for the experts and policymakers to decide it for us, but really we're all walking in step around that. So I look forward, and I have no doubt on the ability and opportunities to engage on this, the thoughtfulness and the alignment. And most importantly, working smarter and not harder. How do we engage, you know, how do we put all these disparate pieces, you know, together in a meaningful way? And so I really appreciate always your leadership and your thoughtfulness around this. And, you know, again, happy to support in any way that I can, both from my role as commissioner as well as, you know, with my work in other places as well. So definitely appreciate that. And then any thoughts on the vendor component? And I'm still stuck on that 8% vendor piece. You know, I can't get over that.
Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner. And I may have misspoken, but I don't think I mentioned vendor in my comments, but maybe I did. But the Keep Colorado Wild Pass, maybe that could have, I'm not sure, mentioned that possibly, but we do have an equity component that's part of that. That would be really that partners in the outdoors, you know, we have, there'd be a fund that would be, you know, set up that would be available for grants and scholarships and so forth. But there's also a separate bill that's tied to the waterfall, if you will, on how the distribution formula for lottery proceeds move forward. And there's going to be a bill that's going to be focused on equity in the outdoors. And there's going to be a significant amount of funding that's going to be geared towards that, but that's separate from the Keep Colorado Wild Pass. And that is, I don't think that bill has been introduced quite yet, but that's in the works. So that could be an avenue for looking at, you know, who gets the grants,
what
type of vendors and so forth. But I may have misspoken regarding vendor component within the Keep Colorado Wild Pass. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And again, happy to follow up. Just always wondering how we can continue to
be as equitable as we can, and not just focusing on the poorest or the right, but recognizing that there are many businesses, small businesses, you know, mid-sized businesses that don't have opportunities and that are qualified, right? So how do we make sure that our contract distribution is proportionate to the population we have here in Colorado? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and I'm happy to answer any of the questions, but I'm also here all day, too, so if there's any follow-up, I'm happy to have conversations in the hall or whatever.
And I'm not sure, because I haven't spoken to Mr. Ryder about that, but that question Commissioner Adams was referred to Mr. Ryder at the last meeting. I'm not sure if he's prepared to give an update on that today with regards to vendor contract selection and percentages and so forth.
Oh, yeah, no. I wasn't expecting him to, Chairman McDaniel.
I'm
so
sure
sorry.
I'm not sure we'll be able to do that today. It would be a good topical matter at some point. I would want it to include how many businesses are owned by minorities in the state of Colorado. You state the proportionality versus population is not yet.
Absolutely.
That it would be by the number of businesses that are owned in the spaces that we need. And I think that is good data for us to see. So at some point, maybe Mr. Wright bring that forward.
Thank you.
With that, I think that's the conclusion of your update. Executive Director Gibbs, I believe Wayne East is giving the Department of Ag update today. So welcome, Wayne, and the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, unfortunately, Kate Greenberg, Commissioner of Agriculture, couldn't come today, so she asked if I would give the update on the agency's behalf. For those of you I haven't met, I am the Wildlife Programs Manager of the Department of Agriculture. First up on a staffing update, it's bittersweet to announce that Dr. Pete Bohr, the state veterinarian, has retired, and he served with the agency for 27 years. I know a lot of the staff had the opportunity to work with him, and I thought he was an exceptional state veterinarian. The good news is I think we have an equally exceptional person that's taking over. Dr. Maggie Baldwin was appointed in that role starting May 1st, just a few days ago. She served as the assistant state veterinarian, and she's helped us through many challenging times recently, including the 2019 vesicular stomatitis virus outbreak, as well as our COVID-19 response. On the Hill, CBA is running two agency bills this year, House Bill 1045, Invasive Pest Control Administration, which would allow CBA to have a greater capacity to support local entities and associations in responding to and mitigating invasive pests. The next one is House Bill 1242, create the Drought and Climate Resilience Office, which commits the department to prioritizing voluntary, incentive-based solutions for agriculture to tackle the impacts of drought and climate change. On the stimulus front, the legislature is moving forward with a number of stimulus proposals that will have beneficial impact on agriculture and rural communities. Among those proposals that would be administered by CDA are $9 million for agricultural fairs and events, $2.5 million to Colorado Proud for marketing, $5 million for renewable energy, energy efficiency, and soil health investments on farms and ranches, $3 million for agricultural drought resiliency, and a $30 million revolving loan fund to support farmers, ranchers, and processors. Next up, our statewide soil health initiative has entered its next phase of engaging in an initial pilot program to test the groundwork for a stewardship verification framework. This would allow willing agricultural participants to objectively track their stewardship and engage in future market opportunities that are valued in soil, water, and climate stewardship. And last but not least, about a year ago, CBA staff created an equity committee that has been meeting twice per week discussing topics relating to EDI. This committee has created a Department of Agriculture EDI action plan, and we are looking forward to working together with our new HR manager on our EDI work and implementation. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes our update.
Thank you. Any questions for Wayne with regards to the department?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Wayne. I had a question on the soil front. I saw a scientific paper probably a couple months ago that the southeast corner of the state atmospheric dust concentrations are skyrocketing at some overturning the dust bowl levels. And I'm wondering if you could tell us, I understand it's always an issue statewide, but the southeast corner of the state seems like it might need to be an area of focus. The trend line is, at least to atmospheric dust concentrations, is somewhat alarming over like the last 20 years or so. I wondered if you could speak to that on the soil front.
Yeah, And thank you for that, Commissioner. Unfortunately, that's outside of my purview. I tend to work on the wildlife programs. That's in a different division. I would be happy to share our soil health initiative with you, and I'll see if I can get a response back to you by midday today.
Thank you. On the wildlife front, I did have a question there also, which is, how do you define a pest in that bill you mentioned on controlling invasive pests?
That's another one I'd have to take a look at. That would be handled by our legislative liaison. I'm not familiar with that one, so that one wouldn't be, I wouldn't think, a rodent, which is one of the things that I take care of in my programs. But again, I'd be happy to share that bill with you if you'd like.
Thank you, Commissioner Tuchin. Seeing no other questions on all the screens and folks I have to look at, I think we can move forward. And we'll move forward to CPW Director Dan Prinsloo with the director's comments. So, Dan, for sure.
All right. Thank you, Chairman. Welcome, Commissioners, Executive Director Gibbs. I appreciate that. Jake, thanks for your help in here. Someone tells me you're fuzzy on the screen, so maybe that's I don't know if that's you or just the camera angle. So,
that's him.
You might have to dance when you talk, so I'll leave that up to you. Again, welcome. Love to be here in person. Appreciate the support of Director Gibbs. On that, like I said, we might have a bump or two, but Chairman will make this smooth sailing through the day. So I would like, we do have, we've had three new commissioners yet to confirm, but this is our first public meeting and that they can meet in person. So it's been a long year for, I think, everybody in the world and everybody in state and state government especially, but I really want to highlight Dallas May, Duke Phillips, and Jay Touchton as new commissioners. And again, it was nice to, they've obviously not met commissioners in person, executive director, etc. I at least went out and visited them in person in the middle of this, but anyway, it's nice to actually have our working group in person. I'd also like to introduce, I've hired in the middle of this pandemic a deputy director. We haven't had a deputy director since into the early 2000s, Carly Gutnick, and she's here in, I don't think the camera's on her, so she's a good camera shot, unlike me, but we'll leave it at that. But I'm thrilled to have her on staff, and again, her first chance to meet commissioners. She has met, obviously, my staff. So I'd like to highlight her. So thank you for that. I was going to bring up Dallas May's Leopold Award, but, somebody beat me to it. So I have X marks on my whole talk. So between Gibbs and Executive Director Gibbs and a few commissioners, you won't have to listen to me very long. Retirement. So, Commissioner Director Gibbs highlighted a couple. I do want to again congratulate Joe Scott Elder, who's just been a peach to work with. Also, Jim Aragon's an area supervisor that just had his last day. He was part of my training class in 1986. He was hired in '84 as a technician. But Mark Leslie, Jim Aragon, Mark Lamb, Pat Tucker, and Steve Kiefer, six of the original 13 are still working 35 years later. So, I hate to say it, but Jim's the first out of the last six remaining, but there were six prior to that. But the reason I bring that up, not only congratulations to all three, I'm probably missing some retirements, but we are going to try and have a large public event sometime late in the summer for all the retirees that we've had over through this pandemic, since we've not been able to celebrate them whatsoever, really, other than virtually. So I want to bring that up. We also had a tough weekend. This won't be the only weekend, but this last weekend, not only as you, I'm sure, saw in the paper, and we continue to get interesting. I won't even read social media because it's so, quite frankly, disgusting. We had a woman lose her life from a bear and yearlings in Durango. As you know, there were human remains in two of the three bears. So we continue to hear about that, but I want to highlight what our local officers did, the community around Durango, the sheriff, the coroner, the R&E Cropsey group in Fort Collins. We had staff that worked, a daisy chain for that evidence to Fort Collins. They worked all night, all day, to make sure that we handled that well. So I appreciate Corey Chick and his staff, Jeff and his staff. I can go down the list. That's just one. I can tell you there was a person that lost their leg in a boating accident in Pueblo, and our Rangers tourniqueted him and saved his life. There was a loss of life at, I believe it was Cherry Creek, maybe Chatfield. And our MERC team went out and discovered that person and recovered them real quickly for their family and ID'd that person. That's just all kind of one day. And that's a bad highlight, but I would just tell you, you can't underestimate, and for people that I'll pick my words fairly carefully, are fairly immune to the people that are involved, probably ought to get a grip. I've got to send a debriefing team to Durango for what my staff has to put up with. So I would think about that before you start making comments on social media. So anyway, I'm going to move on past that. I would like to highlight Castlewood Canyon State Park. Wanted to take a moment to recognize the good news from the Northeast region, the Castlewood Canyon State Park, on earning the gold standard site designation from Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics. The park is the second in our system to receive this honor, which has designated last April, making Colorado the second state park with 2LNT gold standard designations. This award, again, was in April, but right in the middle of pandemic, so we can just kind of highlight that right now. I also want to thank Castlewood Canyon State Park manager Brent Lounsbury and his incredible team of volunteers, including Bev Finnemore, Mike Thomas, the Friends of Castlewood Canyon, and also volunteers from Roxboro State Park to help them with that. And it's a wonderful honor. So I appreciate that. Last couple things. It was interesting. I think commissioners highlighted the shrub plantings in the southeast. Our new private lands coordinator, Rader Averly, invited myself and regional manager Mark Leslie to actually go out and do a planting in the Northeast. I've been working 35 years and never, rode the back of a tractor. I've ridden the front of a tractor before, but it's the first time to be in the back by the PTO and the three-point hitch. I was a little worried they were going to set me up to get ground under the wheel, but they didn't. So I do want to highlight, so area supervisor Todd Schmidt, our private lands access person Ed Gorman, DWM Josh Melby, and technician Josh Hurst, and of course Ray set that up, and Mark and I, there might be a picture of us sitting in the back of the tractor planting these plantings, so both southeast and northeast, there's all kinds of wonderful things going on. I forget, they gave me some statistics out there that just the miles and miles of plantings that have gone on over the years. I know area supervisor Mike Trujillo, when he was at DWM out there, spent 18 years of his career putting tree plantings out there. So you go out there to pheasant hunt, and every one of those juniper tree rows, really every one of those is Parks and Wildlife throughout the years and our staff. So great highlight. I appreciate that. It was fun for me to get out and actually see what people actually do really for a living instead of sit and read policies like I get to do. Last but not least, wildly important goals. Director Gibbs covered a lot, but we're excited about Keep Colorado Wild, Senate Bill 249. Also, we've got, this is our kind of a WIG update, and lots of momentum on outdoor regional partnerships. Last month, we put out an application for funds that can be used to build capacity for plan development. The application deadline is May 20th. And so we're excited to see how much participation. I know Carly and I have had a couple in-person meetings with groups like Envision Chaffee County and NOCO places that are really kind of already doing that space, and we've had a great conversation with them. That can't help but highlight our partnership with GOCO on that and the funding. I see that, and thanks to Carly's leadership, as a really, as a, we're moving forward quickly on that. So I'm excited about that. And obviously fulfilling one of our wigs. Director Gibbs, again, covered the 200,000 additional acres of state trust land in our sister agency, the Land Board, and so that brings us to over 1 million acres of partnership with the Land Board, so again, excited about that. And our EDI WIG, significant progress on our work group at DNR and training sessions within the agency, and I think, I'm going to check real quickly, I think that's it. Thanks for the opportunity to get off track.
Thank you, Director Prinsloo. Any questions? Commissioner Garcia.
Thank you, Chair. Director Prinsloo, so you're talking about retirements, and it just dawned on me when you said that. I don't know if we had this last year with the pandemic, but don't we have a swearing in for our new wildlife officers? I think my calendar says June 18th, and in the past, I know you've invited us as commissioners. So.
If you play your cards right, Commissioner, you could get another invite. It is the Friday before Father's Day. It's probably the 18th, but middle June, I'll make sure we send that out. I know we are working on logistics because we have COVID issues, but I do believe that it's in person with their families. So I will make sure Heather Dugan gets that out to all commissioners and executive director on that. And I'm sure there's plenty of things we're probably missing in the last year. And for that, I'm sure I missed some retirements and things like that. I'll apologize up front. Yeah, we're trying to move to, as you all know, we've been in managed DS, and now we're going to try and manage to a little more normal.
And park rangers, by the way. We supported
yes,
park
both. Correct. Park managers and wildlife managers. It's a very, very great day.
Thank you. Any other questions for Director Prinsloo? Seeing none, let's move forward to agenda item number 8, which is Justin Rutter, Assistant Director of Financial Services, and Justin's going to give us our financial update. I see you there in the screen, Justin, so I'll turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, directors, commissioners. My name is Justin Rutter. I'm the Assistant Director for Financial and Capital Services. I have a financial update for you today. Before I get into the material that was in your mailing materials, I do want to respond to Commissioner Adams' request. I am not prepared to update where we are at on that effort. I do want to clarify that what I had referenced in a previous meeting is the 2020 Keene Independent Research Study. It's a 2020 disparity study. It's a 700-page document. I have not read that. I have read the executive summary, which is a little bit shorter, and recommend the fact sheet, which is 3 pages, to anybody that has a passing interest in the material. I'm waiting for direction from the State Controller's Office or the State Purchasing Office on how we can address that disparity going forward, and when I have that information, I will update this commission. Included in your mailing materials was a 1-page update. It has a couple of items. As you can imagine, it is focused on the legislature. Normally about this time, I'm eagerly counting down the days to sine die, which is the last day of the legislation. Unfortunately, we are going to be going well into June at this point for our legislative agenda. And as was mentioned earlier, some key pieces of legislation were just introduced last week and will be in committee this week. But before I get into the legislation, I do want to talk about CPW's finances in particular. The third quarter closed, which is the end of March, closed just last Friday. So I was unable to include any financials in the material that was sent to you, nor was I able to meet with the finance subcommittee on these materials, especially since I was not able to join you in person today. However, my staff has completed preliminary analysis of the data, and it continues to reflect what we've seen throughout COVID, which is a high level of usage. So if you look at kind of the periods we're looking at, the fiscal year 20 through period 3 would have been through the end of March of 2020, which was non-pandemic months. And then period 3 for this fiscal year is all pandemic months. And we are seeing that Colorado loves their outdoors. We're seeing slight increases in hunting fees over that period, additional increases of fishing, so additional fishing licenses being sold to about 10%, and we're actually seeing about a 40% increase in usage of parks as measured by camping reservations and entry fees. That's a massive increase, and I'm sure you have heard or seen it in our parks. That is translated into approximately a $10 million year-over-year swing in revenues. So this time last year, we had about a $2 million loss on the books. It's not atypical because the fiscal year so far includes 6 months of our kind of downtime, which is the winter, and 3 months of our uptime. The upcoming 3 months are very busy and are very popular for annual pass sales and camping reservations. And in fact, most years, at least since I've been around, during December, we tend to go cash negative in the parks cash fund, meaning that our expenses have outstripped our revenues. We then turn around during the final quarter of the year, and make up that difference and then potentially show a profit by the end of the year. We have not gone cash negative this year, and I don't anticipate us going cash negative. That's a great place for the cash fund. We don't have to take out a loan from the treasury, and, we don't have to pay those fees. So the pandemic has been very good to us financially. Unfortunately, because of how the budget works, we have not staffed up the parks. And so that's something that the leadership team is going to be addressing here shortly. Within the legislature, I did want to point out that on March 19th, the governor's office and the legislative council produced their economic forecasts. That's kind of what the legislature uses to set the budget for the year. It's what they refer to for how they balance their budget. For general fund, it was substantially good news with far more money being available than was originally anticipated. That's translated into the budget that has been passed through the legislature already. However, severance tax, which is the fee that is collected by the state when natural resources are severed from the ground, it continues to be very anemic, to say the least. I had this information up. Looking at the forecast for fiscal year 20, severance taxes totaled $131 million. It's not a final number. It's a preliminary estimate. The estimate for fiscal year 21 is $18 million, so about 10% of what was collected in the previous fiscal year. The severance taxes do support. All right, I just got a message that they lost internet in Grand Junction. So, we will be waiting. Sorry, messaging with Danielle.
Yeah, Justin, it looks like that whole room just lost internet connection. So if you can bear with for a little bit, sorry about that. I'll let you know when it's back up.
Sure, no problem.
Hey there, friends on the phone.
Hey, Commissioner Adams.
Hey there.
Yep,
we're back on. That. No worries. Thank you. And hello, everybody else.
And Kirk, when the others get back, maybe you can just, we can't instant message or chat between, but I am very curious about this photo of yours and what ledge you are looking out on. So, Kirk, if you want to share that while we're waiting, that would be lovely.
Yeah, that's actually at Capitol Reef in Utah. And I think that's my daughter standing out there.
Ah, okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. So incredible that that's right next door, right? I mean, you see it when you go into Grand. Really is incredible. Thank you. And while we're also waiting, Laura, I just wanted to let you know that the presentation I shared this morning will.
Can you just hang on a second, Commissioner Adams?
Absolutely.
Dion, you need to start the video on the D10. And can you make me a co-host? They're starting to come back up. We're just getting the cameras going.
Okay. There we go.
Muted.
All right. And
muted.
The screen isn't, so you could hear everybody here, but Commissioner Adams is muted. Okay.
Justin, can you hear me?
I can, Chairman.
All right. We've already moved forward to item number 9 for the folks on the screen. We haven't begun yet, so you haven't missed anything in the GoCo update. So I'm going to ask you just hang on, Justin. Let item 9 complete, and then we'll come back to item 8. Okay? Thank you. We had multiple technical difficulties, as you can tell, and lost you all, but we're about to turn this over the floor over to Emily Orbanek.
Perfect. That was perfect timing to get my PowerPoint up and running. Thank you all for your kind words. It's certainly bittersweet week for me at GoCo. So it's so wonderful to be mostly in person and over here in Grand Junction. I normally talk about GoCo investment from the community, so I'm happy to end on this note in my hometown. GoCo has invested over $45 million in Mesa County since inception. Some of GoCo's earliest investments were in Grand Junction and the surrounding communities. In the early 90s, GoCo funded the Blue Heron and Watson Island sections of the Riverfront Trail, acquisitions and development in what is now the James M. Robb Colorado River State Park, and capacity funding for the Mesa Land Trust, now the Colorado West Land Trust. More recently, GoCo has invested in support for the restoration of the Gateway School, where Outdoor Wilderness Lab is held, and I know you'll all be getting an update on that tomorrow. Thank you. It's an incredible program, and we're thrilled to be part of it in a small way. Phase 2 construction of the Palisade Plunge, and 2 resilient community grants this past year, including support for the tremendous work of Mesa County Public Health to steward the rehab of trail systems across the valley through a strike team model. We just wrapped up reviewer meetings for the 2021 CPW Directors Innovation Fund. 12 applications were submitted, requesting over $220,000. And no surprise, CPW staff submitted some incredible ideas. And Adrian will update you on those decisions next month after the GoCo Board Award. I feel like I've said this a lot over the past few months. We have a lot going on at GoCo these days. We're in the very tail end of a significant restructure. Our programs team has been interviewing candidates for regional positions based outside of Denver. We had over 150 applications for these regional officer roles, and we hope to have all these folks on board in the middle to end of June. Our communications team is busy hiring a new communications associate and an intern. We had over 250 applicants for those roles. We worked really closely with Dr. Nina Busby Tyler and her HR shop to help us think through every step of this hiring process. During this restructure, we reimagined what our job descriptions look like, particularly qualifications, and we advertised differently. We shifted our thinking from thinking about a culture fit to a culture match and add, all in an effort to make sure that GoFest staff reflects the communities that we serve across Colorado. And we're very excited about how this new regional approach will support a brand new program portfolio that we are also launching in the next couple of months. Our new programs are rooted in 5 guiding values, and these programs will be easier to navigate for partners. They'll build in efficiency and really aim to reduce barriers to GoCo funding. Our regional officers will work closely with communities to support their projects through the process. We're kicking off, or we have kicked off a conversation with the deputy regional managers to help evolve and ensure better coordination with CCW as we move forward with this new program portfolio. Historically, we've required applicants to work closely with CPW to complete an environmental checklist for projects, but we want to ensure that that dialogue is ongoing and more than just a static document, and to most appropriately address the wildlife concerns and really hone in on habitat considerations. So thank you to the DRMs for their support thus far and helping us really inform our thinking around this, and we're looking forward to engaging area wildlife managers later this spring. And as has been pointed out, the most imminent GoCo transition is mine. So Friday is my last day. And I am just thrilled that I don't have to contextualize this place for you, that we're here in person. So it's easy to see why leaving the hustle and bustle for this opportunity made a lot of sense. I'm going to get through this, but I did want to take a moment and recognize some amazing leaders that I've been fortunate to learn from over the past 7 years. Commissioner Adams, Commissioner Blacka, Commissioner Haskett, and Commissioner Hauser. It's been an education for me to watch and learn from you 4 strong leaders around this table. Thank you for all of your wisdom and your poise. Heather Dugan, Lauren Truitt, Carly Kutnick, and Kristen Cannon, and all the amazing women throughout this agency. It's been a privilege to work alongside you for the betterment of Colorado's people and wildlife. And finally, I'm cleaning out my office this week. There's a 400-page book out there called Colorado's Wildlife Story that celebrated the 100-year anniversary of the agency. And in there, there's quotes from Colorado's first female wildlife commissioner. And she said that she would be successful in her role because her mother raised her to be a lady and her dad taught her to be one of the good old boys. And if I have even been marginally successful in my position at GoCo, and certainly with this partnership with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, is because that woman taught me those lessons and a whole lot more. So thank you to all of you, and thank you, Mom, for blazing a trail for a lot of us in this room. And I look forward to working with all of you in my next chapter, and certainly raising a glass when you pass through Western Colorado. So, thank you.
Those are pretty big shoes, Adrian. But I'm sure you'll do a good job.
Any, well, with that, although Emily's walked back, and were there any questions for Emily? I don't see any. So why don't we return to agenda item number 8? Can we kick back to the screen and get Justin Rutter back to the floor? There you are. Justin, I'm not quite sure if you remember where you were at, but hopefully you do, and you can pick up at about that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, somebody was kind enough to remind me when you guys lost us, so I'm ready to pick that back up. I do want to thank Emily for the 4+ years I've worked with her. She's been a fantastic partner and will certainly be missed, but I look forward to working with Adrian going forward. It's a rough transition to go from such an emotional and powerful moment to finances again, but we'll do our best. So I was finishing up my summary of the finances that I viewed for Q3 and was mentioning that Parks has seen increased usage and increased revenues. I'll move on from there to the March 20th or March 19th economic forecast. The Governor's Office of State Planning and Budgeting, along with Legislative Council, both presented their economic forecasts to the legislature on March 19th. That included a great deal of information about how much money is available, and it was largely good news. The general fund was in much better shape than was anticipated, and that's the numbers that the legislature will be using to set their budget and, in fact, have passed the long bill, which is the majority of the budget for the state. Just recently. One thing that was not so positive within that forecast was the severance tax, which is the tax charged on the severance of natural resources from the ground. That in previous years, in fiscal year 20, the preliminary estimate for total revenue collected from severance tax was $131 million. In fiscal year 21, the current estimate is $18 million, so about 10% of the previous year's revenue. And that does have impacts to CPW's budget. We use severance tax in a couple of specific ways. It goes to support state park operations. It goes to pay indirect costs, and it also goes to fund the Species Conservation Trust Fund, which we are a recipient, and the Aquatic Nuisance Species Program. We have taken measures to deal with all of those. Species conservation we fully fund each project nominated each year. So when we don't have revenues available, that just means we don't have new programs to start. So that reduces the amount of work we're able to do, but does not affect current ongoing operations. The Aquatic Nuisance Species Program, we have written a motorboat access grant to cover the cost of the program for the year and to maintain our cash fund balance so that we can weather these variable revenues. And of course, we also receive sticker revenue from the sale, from the registrations of boats, and the boat registrations continue apace and actually are slightly ahead of previous years. So that program has good solid funding underneath it. State park operations is a little bit more challenging. It's about $2.5 million that goes to support our park system. That will not be available this year, most likely. However, with our increased revenues, we expect to be able to offset that through some technical means. Additionally, the Joint Budget Committee has been looking at the Severance Tax Trust Fund and has discussed on the mic making some changes to how that fund operates, including increasing reserves and potentially moving Aquatic Nuisance Species and Species Conservation Trust Fund to a higher priority. Basically, there are two tiers within that fund. The ANS and SCTF are currently in Tier 2, or what is called natural Resources Grant Programs, and there's discussion of moving them to Tier 1, which is the core programs. Lastly, I will just mention that the Joint Budget Committee finalized the Long Bill recently. Included in that is $1.1 million of general fund for the implementation of Proposition 114. That was originally $5 million as it was amended on the floor. It has been reduced to $1.1 million through the reconciliation process between the House and Senate bills. However, that's not entirely bad news. the long bill is not a zero-based budget document. It is a continuation budget document. So what that means is basically when we are building our budget requests each year, we start with numbers from the previous year and then ask for the addition or subtraction of resources. Obviously, these discussions are preliminary at DNR, but I anticipate basically requesting that that $1.1 million continue into future years, and that will be a conversation that we can have with the General Assembly next year. With that, I will conclude my presentation, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Justin. Any questions for Assistant Director Rutter on the financial update? Seeing none, I think that takes us into, oh wait, there I see one now, Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin, just a one point on your memo, and you just mentioned it, that the JBC discussed changes in for a bill to be drafted in regards to that prioritization. Has that actually happened, or is there a bill that has been drafted and planned to be introduced, or is it still just discussions?
Thanks for the question, Commissioner Schaefer. Yes, the bill has been drafted. I've heard of it. I have not seen it, so I don't think it's been introduced. And so I can't really discuss any of the details that I've heard until I'm sure that's been introduced. But yes, that is in process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Schaefer. Other questions? Seeing none, we're up to our break time. It's approximately 10:10, slightly ahead of schedule. Let's reconvene at 10:25. And that'll give maybe us a little extra time to double check our internet connectivity and see if the meeting will flow a little more smoothly as we get into our second phase. So, Dion, could you stop the recording and take us into break, please? Okay. Thank you, Dion. We are recording again. For folks who can hear, we are still encountering technical difficulties, so we're having trouble streaming on some applications, and so it's not all out there. We are recording this meeting, and it will be posted, of course, after that. I think we have the ability, we continue to have the ability for our public commenters to come forward and speak during the meeting. So again, I appreciate your patience and understanding this first combination live Zoom meeting. We're doing our best to try to make this work and the public the availability to be before this commission and meet in these locations. So with that, again, appreciate your patience. We are reconvening now, moving forward to item number 10, which is Chapter W-2 Big Game. This is step 1 of 1, so an action item with regards to the adoption of limited license numbers. So I believe we have Andy Holland here, our Big Game manager, and he's going to speak to this. So
you want to start with Krista Heiner? Is she going to start us off, or should I start, Chairman? I see you're there is the only reason I'm asking.
Yeah.
I can start.
I'll turn this over to you, Krista and Andy. You guys handle it as you'd like.
Sounds good. I just want to start make sure everyone can hear me before we keep going. Can you all hear me?
We can, here in the room.
Okay, great. Great. Well, good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, Executive Director Gibbs, Director Prenslow. I'm Krista Heiner, the Regulations Manager. So let's get started. Agenda Item 10, we have final regulations for Chapter W-2 Big Game, and this is to adopt the limited license numbers for black bear, deer, elk, pronghorn, and moose for the 2021 season. And as mentioned, this is step 1 of 1, final action. If you look at the information for this agenda item, you will first see a memo from Director Prenslow summarizing the Big Game limited license recommendations for 2021. Next will be several spreadsheets, which Andy and Mark will go into more detail. But those have the division specific 2021 license recommendations by species. And then after that, you'll see Chapter W-2 regulations, which are blue in color, also with the 2021 proposed license modifications for black bear, deer, elk, pronghorn, antelope, and moose. So before I hand it over to Andy Holland and Mark Vieira to present our proposed quota recommendations, I want to point out that we changed the format of the regular rifle deer and private land only rifle deer tables, which start on pages 20 and 35. We did this in January, and as a result, we added new tables to summarize the license quotas by season and sex on pages 28 and 40. And so I just want to point those out as being new. And the way these tables were formatted previously made it cumbersome to update each year. And so this new format is easier for us to update and also more closely resembles the format found in the brochure, which will hopefully help customers who reference these regulations as well. With that, I would like to hand it over to Andy Holland to cover the limited license recommendations for deer, elk, pronghorn, antelope, and moose, and then Mark Vieira to cover black bear. Thank you.
Thank you, Krista. Welcome, Andy.
Good morning, Commissioners, Chairman Daniel, Director Prinslow, Executive Director Gibbs. I wanted to make sure that maybe a thumbs up from Kevin or Dion that I'm good.
You're good to go.
Okay, I'll get going then. So this morning I'll be presenting limited license recommendations for deer, elk, pronghorn, and moose, and then Mark Vieira will follow me to discuss bears. Sorry, we'll get going here. Let's use the mouse. We're recommending 250,500 limited licenses, which is a reduction of 5,900 or 7% from last year. Those limited licenses will populate 2,600 individual hunt code quotas, and they make up the majority of hunting opportunity for Colorado's 800,000 big game animals. Those 800,000 animals consist of 136 individual herds or data analysis units. If you hear me say DAU, I'm merely talking about a herd. Before I really get rolling, I wanted to talk about some acknowledgements. These license recommendations represent a significant amount of staff, data analysis, collection, and discussion. They come up from the field from all levels of our agency. I'm just the one that gets to present them to you today. And it's really a culmination of a lot of staff work. There's a lot that goes into this. I'm glossing over it a little bit here, but I just wanted to emphasize that and thank all the staff efforts. These decisions are based on the most current data available. I wanted to take a second to explain a tiered approach. Krista mentioned it, but I'm going to go into a little bit more detail. We use a tiered or nested approach in how we present these recommendations to you and the public, first of which is this presentation, which is by far the most general. It's a statewide summary by species, highlighting a few DAU differences. The commission mailing, the letter to the commission from Director Prinslow, has a similar level of data, but much more comprehensive explanation. The summary by region and species table is actually page 11 in the mailing. If you were just going to look at one page, that's a pretty good one to look at it. I think it's at a scale, which really tells a lot. If you're a data person and want to dive a little deeper, each species has its own individual tab that has every single DAU, not only the license changes by sex, but also where that herd sits relative to its herd management plan objectives. And within each of those individual tables, there are also dashboards of figures that show licensing and populations relative to objective. Finally, the chapter two in the mailing is the most detailed, and it shows the individual hunt code quota for all 2,600 hunts. To discuss a little bit of the information we use to support these license recommendations, I want to start with herd management planning. It's a basis for all of our license recommendations. These herd management plans account for both the biological and social aspects of herd management. They're a public process. Those plans are approved by this commission, and we set licenses to manage those objectives annually. Under the topic here of herd performance and trends, age and sex classification data is collected annually, such as the photo here with the helicopter inventory of elk. This winter, we classified 70,000 deer and 90,000 elk to male, female, and young. We also use survival rates from radio-collared animals, population estimates from models, chronic wasting disease estimates from our mandatory sampling, field observations, and public input and reports. Our officers are constantly checking hunters and getting feedback, and also we discuss a lot of this with landowners throughout the year. You can't just look at one year to the next, like I'm presenting here. It does not paint the full picture, so you also have to consider, say, a 5 or 10 year trend in licensing, which we do as well. And then finally, we use previous year's harvest estimates and harvest rates to set license numbers to achieve a harvest objective that will then manage toward our herd management plan objectives. So moving on and diving in here with deer, you'll see a series of these slides, and the blue line is applicant numbers, and that is essentially demand. The red line is the quota over time, and that's essentially supply. And that's, of course, the purpose of our meeting here today is to approve these quotas. You'll see that over time, deer applicants have increased. Colorado is one of the premier states for deer hunting in the West. This year, we're recommending 102,500 deer licenses, which you can see, which is an increase of 1,100 or 1%. You can see we've been on an increasing trend of deer license numbers over the last number of years. However, we're still not anywhere near back to the license numbers we had prior to the severe winters of 07, 08, and 2010-11. This figure shows deer rifle quotas by sex. You can see that the plains are the shorter bars here. Essentially, our quotas are nearly identical to last from 2020 to 2021. We're very, very quoted. Our recommendations on the plains are very similar. These longer bars are west of I-25. You can see that we're recommending an increase in the purple, which is either sex. I'll talk about that in a minute. The blue bar, which is antlered, west of I-25, you can see a reduction. Statewide, we're recommending a reduction of 2,300 or 4% limited buck licenses. Big game season structure, the calendar reset to the later dates in big game season structure was a driving factor in our buck licensing decisions this year. We are anticipating higher success rates from the later season dates, and higher success means we will need to issue fewer licenses to achieve the same harvest. And then finally, you can see in pink here, the doe license recommendations are increasing 2,800, which is 17% over last year. This slide shows deer sex ratios compared to HMP objectives, herd management plan objectives. You can see that from last year to this year, we've increased the number of herds that are within the buck doe ratios within the sex ratio objective range. However, more than half of our herds are still above their sex ratio objective range. Which leads me to this slide. This is the average buck to doe ratio statewide. And again, we classified this year 70,000 deer from primarily helicopters to get this estimate of 32 bucks per 100 does, which is the same as last year. So last year and this year were both 32 bucks per 100 does post-hunt. You can see that we're reducing intentionally this buck doe ratio over time, but we're still not back to where we were prior to those license reductions I mentioned in the winter of 07, 08 back in this range. Oops. So this map shows all 54 deer herds in the state. And I'm going to use it just to highlight a few DAU-specific changes, as I mentioned in the beginning. So I want to give examples where we're reducing buck license recommendation because herds are now at their herd management plan sex ratio objective. Essentially, we've reduced the buck-doe ratios with hunter harvest. Examples of that are D2, Bears Ears, D9, Middle Park, and D30, San Juan. And I want to show some examples where we're increasing buck license recommendations because we are now above our herd management plan sex ratio objectives. In the Gunnison Basin, examples are D21, Westdale, D22, Taylor, and D25, Powderhorn. Examples where we're increasing buck license recommendations because we're above our CWD thresholds are D43, Sweetwater, D51, South Grand Mesa. And then I'll also take this opportunity to mention those either sex PLOs. If you remember in January, this commission approved new PLO hunt codes for either sex in D2 and D7. those increases are why the HEDOSEX licenses increased to the renew hunt codes. And then those are to target CWD hotspots in D2 and D7. Most of those deer are on private land in November when they migrated to winter range. And so we're targeting those hotspots with PLO HEDOSEX. And finally on this, I wanted to mention that we have in places where we've increased kill license recommendations where we're above herd management plan objective range, population objective range, and those are D2, D7, and then again in Gunnison Basin, D22 and D25. And while I'm talking about Gunnison, I just wanted to mention that these increases in Gunnison Basin on both buck and doe licenses are because those populations are doing exceptionally well. These license recommendations will not get us to herd management plan objectives. The idea is to slow the increases here. Post-hunt, we're still forecasting we will still be above sex ratio objective and population objective ranges in all these herds. So with that, I'll just mention one quick thing on deer herd performance. Our current population estimate is 427,000, which is right around the 420,000 average we've been at for about 10 years. The decade prior to that was marked by dramatic declines in particular meal deer on the West Slope. So in conclusion on deer, we're making a concerted effort to move these populations toward their herd management plan objectives and at the same time reduce chronic wasting disease in herds that are above the 5% threshold. Moving on to elk, you can see that.
Thank you very much. By preference of the commission previously, I have separate motions for each herd. So I think but we also have public comment. So trying to think of and discuss, have a quick discussion with the commission how they'd like to handle this. Otherwise, I'd be asking for six separate motions as we get to the end of the vote. Commissioner Garcia, comment?
Just before you get into that, first I wanted to thank you, Chair McGinn, for your request for additional information on this. And all of the information that was provided in response to your request. And that was then included in our overall material, so we don't see it now as clearly as we did when you requested it. But thank you. I think that's extremely important. And I would ask that we get all of that information in the future. I think it's necessary for us to do the work that we do. Real quick question I had, and this is just more, I want to thank, first of all, Brian and Brad. I reached out to them to talk about, for instance, with deer unit D9, which is up around where I am. But just a general question, I think, is that our customers keep asking about, of course, with their deer herds, is CWD. And I think we've done a good job in addressing the issues. I think we've been given great information. I did see that, 23 of 54 herds now, 43%, are affected by CWD. And so I think the one thing I'd like to see is that I don't believe we have the data yet. It's supposed to be years, to see that if our increase in our harvesting of bucks, is really helpful to CWD. I know that that's been sort of the position of the division, and I agree with it. I do. I think it's a great approach. But we don't have any evidence yet that that's really working, and I'm sure it'll take years. But I'd like to make sure that we continue to remind the public that we are looking at that, and maybe you can help me in just telling me where that data is, where we are with that sort of data.
Yeah, I can make a couple comments on that. Of course, long term, we're really interested to see how this shapes out. And by trying new things like these HEDOSEX PLO licenses to target the hotspots, we're trying to learn as we go, essentially. But what I would like to mention that we do have pretty good examples in Colorado of places where we've reduced CWD prevalence. And I'll use D4 Cooter right here. That was about 15% prevalence in the early 2000s, and we've reduced that to right around that 4.8 or 5% threshold with active management, with having a lot of buck licenses, a lot of deer licenses, and later season buck licenses. And then I would also offer B9, Middle Park, like you mentioned, and D8, State Bridge. Those are two excellent examples that CW prevalence has increased only marginally over the last 20 years from around 1% to 3 or 4%. And through, again, through active management of bucks and issuing quite a few fourth season licenses. And that would be in contrast to a couple of herds like D2 and D7, where for probably harvest management, but maybe other reasons, prevalence has increased dramatically from 1% to like 16-18% in that time. And then just one more thing, if I may. We have published a paper, Dr. Mike Miller has published a paper that demonstrates or at least correlates that buck harvest and later season buck harvest does reduce or prevent CWD from increasing. And there's another West multi-jurisdictional analysis that's in press right now that we participated in that also shows the same thing across the whole Western U.S. and Canada. So I think we're building a pretty good foundation of what works. And the reason the thing that I think is interesting about this is that this is a tool that we are good at. This is a tool that's what we do is set licenses. So it's not some tool that is maybe not in our wheelhouse. Buck harvest management is what we do, and it appears to work.
Okay. And before we go back to the chair, I do support your idea, but I always want to kind of reach out to Grand County folks and D9. Our license numbers for deer are down. And I understand, again, I talked with Brian, I talked with Brad, I understand it. But I would, at some point, I'm going to ask this on deer, elk, and moose, more importantly, moose, maybe. The effect of and what we're doing in response to the troublesome fire as it relates to our license allocations.
I can certainly talk about that on moose, for sure.
Okay. And I don't know, at my understanding, it really didn't have as much effect on the deer and D9, that it wasn't as much of a decision maker. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair. The reason that we're reducing buck licenses in D9 by 15% is because we've made a concerted effort to get to the buck-doe ratio objective in D9, and we've finally gotten there. So we're now dialing it back a little, which is the goal all along.
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Thank you, Andy. Before I move forward, Commissioner Haskett and Judson, so I have separate motions. Put that way, depending on how the outcome of these discussions go, what I'd like to ensure that we do is, well, I'm going to ask you to pause after each species, like we're doing now, answer questions with regards to that. We'll move on to the next species. We'll step through them all. We'll take public comment, as this is an action item. After that public comment, we'll get into final commission discussion and deliberation. We'll determine whether we can do one motion for all species or we'll take them separately, depending on if there are recommendations or motions from the floor that do not align with staff's. So that's the protocol it's going to take, so we can handle them all separately and not go through all the species. So that really opening up the floor to discussions around the deer quota. Commissioner Garcia has begun. Now move to Commissioner Haskett.
Thank you, Chairman McDaniel. I just want to make a couple comments on CWD. The management philosophy is a long haul, and being on the advisory group, I learned a little bit about that, but I think we're presented with a unique opportunity here because of the change in the season structure. Those animals are actually going to be on winter ground, and that's where we actually have more problems is when they're congregated. And I'm going to be interested to see in 5 years when we start testing again, actually, I guess 23 years when we start again, what that's actually going to be. But I think it's a unique opportunity for us to see the change in the licenses and they're actually where we need them to be and be able to hunt them.
Thank you, Commissioner Haskett. Commissioner Tutchin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be a step back question, it's not specific to deer, but it goes back to Commissioner Garcia's request that we be provided with this additional data, and which was a lot to get through a first time. But I was curious, this came to us as step one of one, so it's just a one and done sort of deal. And most items come to us in a two-step process where we see the data, we kick it around, and then we approve it at our next meeting. I'm wondering if given that there's a lot to absorb with all these, we said numbers are not my forte, if it's possible to do these limited license allocations in a two-step briefing with the commission rather than just a one-time deal.
I know that question's been asked you before. I'm not sure who wants to take it.
I can take it. Yeah, I'll start it and then we'll go from there. So, excellent question. Thanks for asking. You're right. This is different. And the reason that we one-step this is because we're still collecting data. So we fly helicopter inventory on elk until February 15th. And then it takes a pretty significant amount of effort to transcribe all those recordings and run the computer models. And then we have license setting meetings in our local areas, regions, and then statewide. And then now we're here. So we're under a really tight time crunch from February when we're still collecting data until now. And so while I'm not going to say that it's not possible, there are things we could do. In my mind, like, for example, you could move the draw deadline later to give us more time, which I would not recommend because then hunters and outfitters don't have as much time to plan. So we're sort of pinned between hunters want their license and their application result and our data collection. And the other thing that if we did figure out a way, so for example, using average harvest success, like I mentioned earlier, to set license quotas rather than using the current year's harvest, that might buy us a couple weeks. My concern would be how do we process and handle public involvement over 250,000 licenses for 136 hunt code, or sorry, 250,000 licenses for 2,600 hunt codes. What does the public involvement process look like over a two-week period for that? Because the commission mailing for the next step would be essentially later that month. So that's just a couple thoughts on that. But the really brief version to the question is we're still collecting data up until February. We don't get harvest until March. Then we have a series of meetings internally to get to this point.
Andy, I think your big boss, Director Prinsloo, wants to add a couple comments to this.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Commissioner Tutchin, good question, Andy. Really good answer. I just reiterate also that, you know, in February, we're still in winter in Colorado, so Georgia, Florida, where they're hot. And we're cold, so we've had die-offs all the way into April and May. And so we take that into account. We also balancing, we used to have, would be the license, the season setting, which we knew now in March or in January, actually. And we had that combined with license numbers. And that was late. And so we balanced because our constituents want to know, by June and July so they can make scheduling, for their vacation or their hunts. And so really there's a ton of information coming. Winter, you know, flights, et cetera, all the modeling, all the public meetings in there. So the other thing over the last few years is staff has gotten this to commissioners a week or two earlier. Hence why you got that big packet of data. Specifically for that reason, we understand it's a ton of data, but it won't work if you go into June and then pull out the draw. So that's a couple added things, but we definitely move that up and appreciate reading his staff in that where they give it to the commission and to the public early on this item for your basic question.
Did I see that? Any other comment, Reed or Brian, about that? Or
I can add it when I get going back in.
Okay. I just wanted, this is Commissioner McDaniel, of course, add to Commissioner Garcia's comment. This is to me the classic rock and hard place in terms of timing. Very difficult, very appreciative of the information and the ability to go through it. And it's a really difficult spot for commissioners to be in. You're getting that data very late. You don't have much time, yet it is, you know, the most critical thing we do in setting the license quota for the upcoming season. And also as a sports person, I want to see that. I want to see the draw occur. And for us to advise the folks that want to travel or live here in the state of Colorado, participate in our big game season. So I'm not sure what the answer is. Maybe we can think on that some more. But I do know the agency is doing all it can to get that out as quickly as possible. So, you know, hopefully we'll continue to evolve and work on that. We have a question from a commissioner online. I can't see the screen. Luke, is it Commissioner Schaefer?
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Andy here, or a request, actually. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail and explain the rationale behind the antlerless increases in D2, D7, as well as D22 and 25 for everyone's edification, but certainly for those that are listening along, because there is a, you know, it's a substantial increase.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question, Commissioner Schaefer. And I can actually tie the previous discussion back into that a little bit. The increases in those DOE licenses, as I mentioned, are to manage to those herd management plan objectives. And sort of back to our original discussion or previous discussion about longer time frames or a two-step. The way that we look at this is we take a lot of time to do these herd management plans and to set these objectives. There's no rush on those, and we want to do them right, and we want to get them right. And when we set those sex ratio objectives and those population objectives, then the way that our staff look at this process of license quota setting is we are managing to those commission public process objectives. And so that's kind of from a staff perspective, that's how we look at this, is we're managing to those objectives that were set not in haste. And so as long as we're essentially doing what we said we were going to do, it might buy us a little bit of trust or time in that license setting process. And then like Director Prinsloo had an excellent addition to my answer that this is when April is when we lose most of the adult does on a severe winter. We've been fortunate that we've had mild winters. And so we haven't had that discussion in these presentations lately, but it will happen again. We will have a bad winter again. So back to the later points on specific herds, Commissioner Schaefer, D2, all the short answer is all those herds are above their herd management plan population objectives. And so that's why we're increasing the licenses. And in the case of D7, if you'll remember, in September, the commission approved the D7 herd management plan, which lowered the population objective range more in line with what we feel the habitat can support. And so by lowering that population objective, that then opened the door to allow us to harvest does, whereas before we were not able to because we were below that objective range. And then in Gunnison Basin, there's a history of die-offs in Gunnison Basin when we have severe winters. Thankfully, it's been a while. After the last severe winter of 07-08, when we redid those herd management plans, we lowered the population objective ranges and the buck-doe ratio, sex ratio ranges in those three herds to allow us to harvest, more deer prior to the next severe winter. That was the rationale. Those herd management plans are coming close, to being open for revision so we can have that discussion again. I know oftentimes people want more deer, and so do we, quite frankly, but we also want to make sure we have the habitat to support them in a severe winter. Does that answer your question, Commissioner Schaefer, or am I totally missing?
No, you're right on point. I just want to make sure that folks understood some of the underlying rationale. I also just want to take the time to sort of reiterate a comment I've made several times, which is it would be great to see the division working with, you know, the ag or the extension offices, but having a better understanding of the nutrition that's available on the landscape, to just have a different information point that's being embedded into this process. Because as we're entering into what is now, you know, historic level drought and aridification, particularly on the western slope, we're all aware that the range is becoming less productive, and that's part of this this concern in regards to, you know, winter kill for certain. But being just having more information points, I think particularly into what we have on the landscape, is extremely interesting to me, and I think others like Commissioner May.
Yeah, drought's insidious. Deer survival is actually pretty high in drought years, but long term it sets the stage for a lot of head scratching and wondering why deer herds aren't performing, and it's just because the habitat is in poor condition from drought conditions. We do, Commissioner Schaefer, we do have 5 intensive mule deer monitoring areas where we monitor, in addition to survival on adult does and fawns, we also weigh all the fawns we capture every winter. So we have fawn weights, and then we do body condition work in several herds after winter body condition, or pre and post winter body condition rather, to look at what condition they're coming in off summer range and what condition they're leaving winter range in. And so there's a lot of really cool data that I really glossed over in that one slide at the beginning. But at some point, we'd love to share that information.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Other questions for Andy with regards to deer? Now I'd like to ask my own with regards to that. Andy, if you could elaborate a little bit. One of the things we talked about last year was, of course, the shift of the season, which really occurred this year to a greater magnitude. And, of course, the expectation that we'd reduce buck licenses in the later seasons, move them a little earlier, which you have done, which is reflected in here. I'm not sure if it's more of a comment than a question, but I would ask that we be very careful and we watch very carefully with regards to the success rates that happened in 2021 with the shift that we made. Was it conservative enough? Because it could have a pretty dramatic effect, of course, in the deer herds that are out there. And I don't know if you want to comment on that, because we really didn't speak too much about that shift in more detail. You mentioned it, but that occurred between third and second, not so much fourth season.
Yeah, that was the basis for the majority of our license reductions in my buck license recommendation, was the discussion. And we're still having those discussions internally. And a lot of it's going to come down to the weather. What happens in November with snow, and we won't know that obviously until it happens. But like you said, some places we moved licenses from fourth to third and third to fourth because we expect that they'll function. Like success rate in second might be similar to third. And as it relates to Gunnison, Commissioner Schaefer's question, in Gunnison they actually used the later previous year's later season dates success rates to estimate harvest. So they already sort of buffered that in a little bit in those Gunnison license recommendations. But yeah, this is a new thing. This is a new season date, and you're right. It just shifted. The calendar reset was this year, not last. The season structure, we're in our second year of 5, but the calendar date shift was really this year. And so we are in late dates, and we did, when we approved those big game season structures, we did it with the intent of increasing harvest. By making longer gaps so animals redistribute off private and onto public, and they're more likely to be at lower elevations out of the mountains and more visible.
Thank you, Andy. I don't think I see any other questions. Why don't you move on to elk?
Okay, moving on to elk. You can see that elk demand or applicants in the blue line. The demand in the blue line has been fairly steady for 20 years, but just this year really popped. We got a lot of elk applicants this year, almost 250,000. And like deer, I wanted to point out that the disparity between supply and demand is increasing. Over the last 18 years, we've been recommending reductions in elk licenses for 18 years straight, and see in the red line. And this year's license recommendation total is 123,900. And that's down over 72,000 in those 18 years, which is 37% reduction. And I expect that to continue. The reasons behind that are, as we get to population objective in these elk herds, it takes a lot fewer cow licenses to maintain an elk herd than it does to reduce it. And then the other aspect of that is we've seen cow ratios decline over those 18 years, which we've talked about in previous years. And so you can harvest a lot fewer cows with lower calf ratios. You just don't have that productivity. On the next slide. So this slide is out quota by manner of take. And I wanted to use this to highlight, so you can see blue is archery, red muzzleloader, green is rifle. I wanted to use this slide to highlight one of the major changes this year in the 5,000, within that 5,700 reduction in elk licenses from last year to this year. One of the largest components, excuse me, is a 3,200 license reduction in the E24, E30 and E31 archery quotas down in Durango. If you guys will remember, last year we limited what previously they were over the counter. Last year we limited those three DAUs, and in doing so, we set license quotas intentionally high to make sure that anybody who applied would draw. Well, now we have the benefit of knowing the demand for those hunts, and so the 3,200 reduction essentially sets those quotas at what was sold last year. So again, anybody who applies should still draw, but we're fine-tuning that quota. And then on the rifle quotas here, you can see we're recommending a 2,200 rifle limited license reduction, which is 2%, in keeping with that trend over the last 18 years. And then just as a final note on elk populations, our elk population estimate is 294,000, which is a slight increase over last year. Our elk herds are responding to these dramatic cuts in cow licenses. They're not responding probably as quickly as we'd like, but they are coming back up and on the increase, responding to pretty major reductions in cow licenses. Again, if we had higher calf ratios, they'd come back a lot quicker. So with that, I can stop on elk.
Any questions for Andy, Commissioner Garcia?
Thank you, Chair. Andy, thank you. And thank you for bringing up the archery in 24, 30, and 31. I think it's always important to reach out and make sure that our customer, the archer, understand, because there was a lot of concern on their behalf when we started doing limiting licenses. And it's a little difficult, as you said, we set those intentionally high so that there wouldn't be as much concern. It's a little bit more difficult because when they run limited, they can move around, right? So it's really hard to narrow down exactly how many of them, were carryovers. But now we do know that we provided a vast number of limited licenses, and they simply weren't bought. So I think that's important for our archery people to understand as we move forward, because I think we may be looking at doing this in other areas down the road. And so I want to make sure that we keep that conversation alive and not forget that we did this. And this is why we don't have reductions, but thank you for that. I did have another, and you said it, and our populations, particularly in the Northwest, are above our objective range. And yet we keep reducing the number of licenses. And so I guess the question is, luckily in E8, which is my area, 18 and 181, there was no change. We've got the same numbers as we had last year. But reduction in licenses with populations above objective range.
Yeah, that's definitely the case in some of our elk herds. And the short answer to that is some of those elk plans are getting quite old. They're sort of past their best buy date. And I think in some of those herds, we've already heard loud and clear from hunters and outfitters, and I think even other segments of our publics that they would not like to see any further reductions. And so I think some of that you might be catching us hedging a little bit. Those plans are overdue, where they're a priority for us to complete plans. You guys have seen how many herd management plans we've put before you in the last year, and so those elk plans are a priority, and we expect the population objectives to increase, because I think people would be pretty upset if we actually managed to those like 15-year-old objectives.
That's it, exactly. Thank you.
That looked like a leading question to me, Commissioner Garcia. Any other questions with regards to Commissioner Touchton?
Thank you. Andy, I wondered if you could speak to the, I guess, the right-hand side of the map, the big white spot on your DA UMass, the Plains, in two respects. What the situation with licenses out there is, my understanding is it's fairly liberal, and that we're essentially managing for extirpation, close to it. And the other thought is whether we can create some new DAUs on the plains for some of the areas that might be more receptive to elk, because, this area, many, like Betsy's house and my house are in the same DAU. No elk goes between those two places. So this is not biologically accurate. And I think elk would be well received in some areas on the plains, and we could build some new huntable, sustainable populations. I wondered if you could sort of speak to those two issues.
Yeah, so first of all, yes, elk licenses are very liberal on the plains. They're over-the-counter, list C. They're very attainable. They're not in this limited license realm that we're talking about here. And the reason for that is the tolerance for elk, social tolerance for elk with landowners and ag is much lower out there on the plains. So your second question, could we manage differently? That would be a discussion that we would need to have with the public and with the commission at some time. That's what I thought.
I'd love us to have that discussion because again, I think I know most of the people in some of these former DAUs, and I think some of them would be receptive.
Thank you, Commissioner Jackson, Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Andy. One question, just following up on Commissioner Garcia's comments. Is there any effort underway for new issue papers from staff and regarding licensing? I say this just because one of the things that was reiterated in both the sportsperson caucuses that I attended, or two of the three at least, what was this push towards limited licensing writ large around archery and some criticism for us not doing so previously. I'm just wondering if there is still analysis occurring and if that's something that we might expect in the near-term future of the next year or two.
Commissioner Schaefer, I can't say what issue papers staff are discussing in all the various areas. What I can say is the deadline for those is in August every year, August 15th. And so between now and August is when staff will be working on those regulation changes that then will become before you at draft in November and final in January. So all I can do is talk about the process, not what's happening, because I wouldn't see those until August. But where I think maybe we're listening, if that's sort of an idea that you're proposing.
We will see. It's one that I've heard quite a few comments, which I thought was interesting. And so I just wanted to ask the question. I appreciate you outlining how that process works and see how it fits in with many of the other issues that staff are working on. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Schaefer. Any further questions with regards to elk? None? Let's move on to what's next, Cromhorn.
Okay. So Cromhorn applicants increased at a pretty similar trend over time until they've spiked dramatically after you draw, like a lot of other species have. You can see demand has increased pretty substantially the last few years. Our limited license recommendations before you today total 23,600. Which is down 1,700 or 7%. The majority of this reduction is in the southeast region, where more than half of our pronghorn reside. And there's two reasons for this reduction. The first being COVID-19 prevented our inventory flights last summer. We do our pronghorn inventory pre-hunt in the summer. COVID-19 prevented us from doing those flights. So we don't have the data in a lot of those important big herds. And then secondarily, the severe drought that was mentioned earlier by Commissioner Touchton, what we know from pronghorn productivity is fawn production and survival is dramatically down in drought years. So we're not only expecting we're expecting those ratios, those fawn production to be way low, and we don't have the data. So between the two of those factors, we believe it's prudent to reduce those licenses on the plains. And then this figure shows that there's a slight reduction in buck licenses, but the majority of that license reduction is with doe pronghorn. These are per rifle. And the herds that I'm talking about that have the majority of those reductions are pronghorn herd 5, 7, 8, 20, 1, and 33. Those are the bulk of those reductions. The drought was worse it's been bad everywhere, but it's worse as you go farther south. And that's our current pronghorn population estimate is 77,000. That's down somewhat from our peak of 82,000 about 4 years ago, and that was intentional. We've intentionally reduced those to get to our pronghorn population objectives. And that's all I had, Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions with regards to pronghorn? Commissioner May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, I appreciate this information. For me, I can apply this more to the pronghorn situation than I can elk, for example. And the reason for reductions is substantial, I think, because you couldn't fly. But you know that the severe drought in southeast Colorado has put the pronghorn herd under a lot of stress. And a practical thing that I can apply to that is, over the last 20 years, as we have experienced pretty severe form of drought, there have been two times in 20 years that I've seen young bachelor groups of males come out of their historical habitat. They come into the irrigated farmland on the alfalfa fields. And I can tell when that happens, pronghorn are under a lot of stress. Well, that's happened on our places the last 3 weeks. We have a young group of bachelor males that are lost. They're trying to find somewhere else. There's feed available, but it's not where they want to be. So, I think it just backs up your reasoning and your hypothesis that is warranted, that reduction in licenses is warranted because they are under a lot of stress. So I just want to say that despite all of the biology and science that you apply to this, real world application backs it up in my opinion.
Thank you, Commissioner May. Commissioner Touchton.
Thank you. Andy, I've got a few questions. I'll just thrown out and you can hopefully remember. But did you mention that licenses were down in A13 and A18? I couldn't hear you when you said your list.
I didn't mention 13. I can look to see specifically, but those were not two that I mentioned that had the majority, that caught my eye as having the largest reduction. But I can check while we're talking. Keep going all of okay. While we're talking.
Then the second thing was, are we on course to fly this year so we can get the missing data?
Yeah, we are. Last year, we were all scrambling with COVID to try and figure out how to put multiple people in a confined space for many, many hours at a time. And we figured that out. We have flight protocols that we used this winter successfully to fly our winter here and out flights. I'm getting thumbs up from the support.
Yeah. Okay, and then I commend you guys for being proactive and conservative. I think that drought is severe. My own observations, like Dallas, are the pronghorn are hurting. I look more for fawns, and last year was pretty bleak for fawns. But what I wonder is, I have a guess. I know our guys did road-based surveys. I would guess fawns were down more than 7%. I guess they were down about double figure. And so I'm wondering if the 7% reduction in licenses, how that works to make up for what I believe is more than a 7% reduction in fawns.
Yeah, you're correct. The 7% you're mentioning is the license reduction that we're recommending. And the difference is that many of those herds are still above their objective. And so we actually, in the twisted way, can use the drought to help us get to objective. But so that's a fine, that's a, you know, nuanced fine tuning of DOE licenses. We're using both, essentially, harvest and the reduced bond ratios to get there. So that's why it's not an equal. I think we would all agree that the bond ratios were down way more than 7%. And then as far as your other question, team did not change indo license recommendations. And 18 increased by 1%.
Any further questions with regards to the pronghorn species quotas? Seeing none, let's move forward to moose.
Okay, this one's a little depressing, but we'll make the best of it. The application rate for moose, as you can see, is meteoric here the last couple of years. We had 53,000 applicants this year. The good news is our moose herds are doing well, and we're recommending an increase to 532 moose licenses, an increase of 7 bull and 5 cow, which brings us to a total of 236 bull and 298 cow. The one herd that I want to point out is M3 here, and the one unit I want to point out is GM 18, which Commissioner Garcia alluded to earlier. That's the one herd that's bucking the trend of increasing quotas. We're recommending a reduction in quotas of 7 bull and 7 cow in there, and that's totally in response to the East Troublesome Fire. There's a couple of reasons for that. We don't know how the moose herd was affected, and we don't know how the willow and aspen communities were affected in some of those really severe burn areas. And then to follow up, a secondary issue that we're concerned about is we don't know what of those areas will be opened by the Forest Service to allow hunting. And so between the two of those, we're reducing those recommendations this year to make sure that the people that draw have a place to hunt. And we're looking forward to getting into those areas this summer, as well as the Cameron Peak Fire areas, to see really what things look like, you know, now that the snow is melting.
Commissioner Garcia.
Thank you. That is really good information. I think that's important. Especially the people up in Grant County. One of the films I was talking earlier about films, I can't remember which one it was, but I found it. I surprised me that moose are my favorite, right? That they're more dangerous in terms of human interaction than our lions and our bears. Is that right? Yes. I thought the oddest part too in talking with people from the division is that they're hard to count. I never really thought about that. You know, they're awfully big. You'd think you'd be able to count pretty easy, but that's my understanding, is they're hard to count. But all of that leads me to the fact that our numbers are really, really, really growing. Our population is projection 2,200 in the Northwest, and our objective range is only 1,400. And so this is one I hope that we're going to do something about the objective range, because if you just, as you said earlier on the elk, if we just looked at that, you'd say, wait a minute, why aren't we issuing more licenses, particularly with the demand that you've got? But I, as a person who has them in my driveway, I love more than my driveway, the better. My wife, not so much, because they eat her flowers, but I love seeing them there. So I'm not one who's looking for an increase in licenses. I think we need to, frankly, take a look at our objective range. Again, I think it may be even more important as we start talking about wolf reintroduction and their interaction with wolves. I think it'd be good to have a better picture of our wolf population and our objectives. So, but thank you for what you did in 18.
That's extremely important. I mean, I put the fire literally within 100 yards of my home. And now the moose don't have a lot of food. And they also don't have a lot of places to hide. So it's going to be a very odd hunting situation to come onto my property because I have a lot of green things. There's not a lot of green things up there. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, and I'll just comment on the both things that you mentioned. They are actually very difficult to enumerate. I don't think we've ever discussed this, but I started my career as a biologist in Middle Park, and so I've flown those moose, and moose are different. You know, we rely on that flight response for deer and elk. You can get those herds moving, you can get them to move in the trees, and then you can work with them as they move through openings and things from the helicopter. And a moose just stands there and watches you. They're not moving. And so they don't move, and if they're in thick timber, like those Middle Park, the riparian corridors are fairly narrow. So unless you catch them right in the willows, they're in the spruce fir, and they're pretty tough to find. North Park is a different situation. We were actually pretty successfully fly moose out in the broad expanse of willow corridors out there. And then your second point about plans with moose, because of that, we're looking more and more toward things like spread, antler spread, age of harvested bull. We pull a tooth on every harvested moose and age those with some amount of aging. And so we're using things more like age of harvested bull and spread. And then we've also had our researcher, Eric Bergman, has had a he's just wrapping up his moose research, and he's looking at like calf at heel surveys and things like that we could use instead of the traditional deer and elk flights and models on moose because they really don't work very well on this.
Wonderful. I really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Garcia. Seeing no further questions on moose, let's move forward to the last category, bear.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just about done. Let me wrap. I wasn't quite finished when we jumped in there, but it was a good segue. So our moose herds, as Commissioner Garcia mentioned, are doing very well. They're up to 3,200. We now have moose hunting in 72 game management units, up from 39 in 2013. And then just in conclusion, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for all your wonderful questions. I'm merely a Nalgene into this meeting, which is a testament to your excellent questions. And these 250,000 licenses that we're recommending for the 2,600 hunts represents the majority of the hunting opportunity for these big game animals in Colorado, these 800,000 animals. And these recommendations are designed to manage these 136 herds to their herd management plan objectives that the commission approves. So with that, thank you. I'm finished.
Thank you, Andy. I believe we have Mark Vieira now to chat with us about the bear quota.
I need a bigger algae in it.
Well, we're getting set up here.
Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Director, Executive Director Gibbs. My name is Mark Vieira. I'm Colorado Parks and Wildlife's Carnivore and Fur Bear Program Manager, and I'll be presenting staff's Black Bear Limited License Recommendations for 2021 here today. Similar to what Andy mentioned, I would like to thank and acknowledge all the hard work and effort that went into these recommendations from biologists and terrestrial staff, from BWMs and regional staff, and all the behind-the-scenes folks, the CSRs, the information education folks, licensing staff, and really most layers of our agency that collaboratively work on the management of black bears. We'll kick it over to the next slide, I think, here in a sec. Thank you.
us with that? Or? Pretty quick. There you go. So right quick on next. Thank you. You all were having a good discussion about different metrics that are used for ungulate species and measuring them for management purposes. Management of bears is in fact accomplished quite differently than that for deer and elk as well. We can't conduct aerial inventories for bear populations. We don't manage sex ratio objectives, and we don't model DAU level populations as we do for ungulates. Bear license recommendations are instead supported by an evaluation of a different suite of indicators, which I'm going to briefly report on here. One of those indicators is harvest composition. So changing proportions of age and gender classes in harvest can provide an indication of population trend. We annually examine the most recent 3 years of bear tooth data to obtain age classes in harvest and evaluate where each DAU performs against those trajectory objectives. The upper right-hand side of the slide, you can see the sort of bracketed percentages that we're using to evaluate trajectory for each DAU. In DAUs with goals of decreasing the bear population, harvest composition and disease are broadly indicating these same trajectories. So in other words, we are moving towards objectives. Bear damage claims and bear human-bear conflict rates are also recorded and evaluated against objectives. The long-term number of total annual claims in Colorado continues to decline, but the total annual dollar value of those claims has been consistently flat for about the last decade, although it did drop in the last full calendar year 2019 that we have data presented for here. Our ability to consistently record human-bear incidents, which includes conflicts, are really greatly improved over the last 2 years with the development of our mobile application. This wildlife incident app, which allows staff to record bear incidents from a phone or a tablet or a computer, replaces a paper form that we historically used. From January 1st to December 31st, 2020, we reported just under 5,000 bear incidents of various types statewide, and this is actually a reduction from the previous year. The statewide total for relocated bears for the 2020 calendar year was 118 bears, and this includes bears moved by Parks and Wildlife, as well as orphaned and rehabilitated cubs that we took in and rehabilitated and denned the following winter. Lastly, surveys of natural bear food sources conducted in the summer and fall of 2020 were about at the 10-year average for the Northwest region. The Northeast and the Southeast region were just slightly below average, and in the Southwest region, we recorded a poorer year. Relative to the past. So mortality. Before jumping into our 2021 recommendations, I'd like to briefly touch on bear harvest and mortality from 2020. Last year, we had a fairly high level of non-harvest bear mortality, and that would be the blue and the green bars on that graph. We recorded 634 non-harvest mortalities, with 403 of those being control kills. And control would be CPW, APHIS, landowner, and that's the portion that is shown in the blue bar on the graph, with roadkill mortalities making up the other portion, which is largely the other 80% of the green other bar is roadkill mortalities. So you can just imagine that when we examine our present level of control and roadkill mortalities in 2020, this was actually equal to the entire statewide harvest we had as recently as 15 years ago. So sort of another indicator of the growing bear population we've had in Colorado over the last couple of decades. Our 2020 total harvest was 1,561 bears. That is the yellow bar. And as you can see there, it's by a little bit our highest harvest record to date. This harvest in 2020 was likely due to the increased number of hunters we had in the field, which was achieved
via the over-the-counter season structure implemented in certain EAUs per the big game season structure. So to that point, we cannot talk about limited licensing without recapping the outcome of the new big game season structure that was implemented last fall for the first year of this cycle. As you may recall, their season structure changes initiated in 2020 were aimed at removing unnecessary barriers to bear hunting whenever possible to achieve DAU plan objectives or bear management plan objectives while still managing hunter crowding during the early seasons and in certain highly limited deer and elk hunts. This 2021 big game brochure map that you see on the slide, which is consistent with the one that we also published in 2020, shows in the colored units, the colored DAU groups, those that employ the licensing scenario, which was known, is known as the unlimited add-on strategy. This offers over-the-counter licenses in archery, muzzleloader, and concurrent seasons for those that already possess deer and elk licenses for those units. And this was in DAUs that had a management objective of reducing bear numbers. The other approach, which is called the limited strategy, and that's the portion of your map that is left in white, is for EAUs that had a stable management objective or were already reaching their harvest objectives. In these EAUs, bear seasons continue to be available as limited licensed hunts only. The exception is that under both of the two strategies, all private land only bear licenses are sold over the counter in the 14 EAUs where we have those seasons in place. Our current management objectives are to reduce bear populations in 10 EAUs while stabilizing the population at present level in 7 others, in the remaining 7. These objectives from the DAUs are important because they're what guided the selection by managers of which of these two licensing strategies were available to them from the big game season structure. I've shown you a graph here of license sales comparison. Well, it's a little different than what some of the ones Andy showed, but this graph shows bear license sales by residency over the last 3 years. So purple is the contribution of resident sales, and orange is the contribution of non-resident sales. So if you take your eyes to 2018, which is the top bar, and kind of use that as a baseline, you can see that we had an increase of about 5,000 licenses from 2018 to 2019, but nearly all of that came out of the orange. So that was nearly all a non-resident contribution from 2018 to 2019, which was a result of our non-resident fee reduction that we did. Drop down now to compare 2019 to 2020, you will see another overall increase of about another 6,000 licenses. So we sold an additional 6,000 licenses in 2020. However, this time, if you look at the difference between the purple and the orange, you'll see that those contributions were essentially a split. We picked up about another 3,000 resident hunters and about another 3,000 non-resident hunters, and this was likely due to the increased availability and opportunity that we had through over-the-counter hunting in a number of those DAUs. So if you review the 2021 bear license recommendation spreadsheet in your big game packet, I believe the bear portion that I'm referencing over on page 11, you'll see that staff is recommending 20,700 limited bear licenses for 2021. This slide here shows limited license recommendations in red, that's the red line, and past license sales in green. Andy showed you slides that also had application rates. If you're curious, bear application rates recently have also increased and were 36,000 last year. The dotted red line there, represents the 2021 proposal for limited licenses only. And just as a reminder, since we don't set any unlimited over-the-counter license numbers, that is why you'd be able to have license sales, the green, in 2020, exceeding limited license numbers, because that portion is made up with over-the-counter sales, which are not limited licenses. The recommendation for 2021 is nearly the same as 2020, but it adds a net of 185 licenses statewide over last year. Staff is proposing an increase of 385 bear limited licenses in 3 DAUs, and these are attempting to provide additional opportunity in DAUs that need that harvest to reach objective. In 3 other DAUs, we're proposing a reduction of 200 licenses, which is really just fine-tuning those limited hunts in units that already have an over-the-counter opportunity in archery muzzleloader as well. None of these 200 license reductions would cut hunter opportunity as those hunts are being undersold currently. So in sum, limited license recommendations are nearly the same as last year, and our non-resident pricing and over-the-counter options are showing a success in addressing the commission's big game season structure bear goals that we went through at the season structure last year. So with that, I thank you for your time and certainly take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mark. Any questions, Commissioner Touchton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, I had a question on the dramatic growth in non-resident licenses, the over-the-counter licenses, from like 13% to 32%, from 18 to 20. And you said that this current year, 2020, that we were able to add some resident licenses back to that increase. And I'm wondering if there's any suggestions you might have that we could tweak to get more of that, what's currently orange, into the hands of residents. And the one thing that occurred to me, and I'd like your response, is if we started asking non-residents to pay the, or we quit giving them the licenses at a discount so that there is again a distinction between residents and non-residents, and that might increase the percentage of those licenses that are going to residents.
Thank you, Commissioner. A couple thoughts on that question. I guess I'm not sure that in the difference between 2019 to 2020, if we attribute it to the availability of over-the-counter licenses, which are available to residents and non-residents, which was by design, right, per the new big game season structure. That availability to reduce non-resident to give to not to resident, if I heard you correctly, I don't think in the over-the-counter situation we could or we need to worry about that. They're issued over the counter. In the case of the resident contribution and the fee reduction you referenced that we started in 2019, that fee reduction appears to have an impact on more non-resident participation. That's correct. I don't know if changing that pricing would then necessarily provide more licenses or more availability for residents, per se, in the case of AIR. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have a lot of over-the-counter opportunity and a number of units, even in limited cases, that are not necessarily selling out or are reaching that sales level, well into the late summer.
Sorry, just one quick follow-up. Is there a differentiation in success rate between residents and non-residents? Do you have any sort of data on that?
I better not. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue. So I don't. I couldn't tell you that off the top of my head. I can look into that and get that for you for sure.
Thank you, Mark. Director Prinslow would like to make a comment.
Yeah, just Commissioner Touchton, just to add and clarity, because I don't think you're on the commission yet, but as part of the five-year season structure on bears, both strategies were not only price reduction for non-resident and resident, they both went into effect. And secondly, that over-the-counter option where significantly under DAU were part of both strategies of the game season structure. So those are effective, but both of those came prior to you being on there. So they're moving the right direction. We have a lot of data to crunch on there. So great question, but that I think predated you, so I just thought that would be helpful.
Commissioner Haskett, can
you add a little bit of that? I think, if I remember correctly, part of it was also we weren't achieving our objective of license sales, and our success rate was also extremely low, and I don't think it's gone up a whole lot, but we're actually getting closer to achieving our objective, I believe, of the license sales that were out there. We just weren't selling any licenses.
Right. But just we increased sales by about 20% from 2019 to 2020. And our harvest went up about 12 to 15%. So it didn't track 1-to-1, but there was an increased harvest that presumably came about due to that increased availability over the commons.
Thank you, Mark. Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to touch on that as well. It'd be really interesting to see some more data regarding success rate, or harvest rate. It's extremely low. And I don't know if there's much that we can do around that, but I do have concerns where, you know, previous discussions regarding, essentially the, landscape health conditions, particularly like in Southwest Colorado, where we're seeing, you know, record drought. Not only does that lead to conflicts, but it leads to, you know, some natural processes that aren't necessarily ideal in some cases, which is not a whole lot of food out there for bears at all. And if there's a way to be able to increase some of those success rates to be able to better manage populations, it'd be great to have, you know, further information or discussion on, but also just having a better understanding of where success is highest and how or who that is hunting in those areas would be, you know, both, I'm both curious about it, but I also wonder if it can help inform our strategies further. So thank you.
Commissioner. Thank you. A couple points to elucidate there. Our September rifle season, which is still limited statewide in all DAUs, is by far the most successful season. I can't tell you between residency status, but we're in the low teens with September success rates on limited September rifle. Then when we drill down into archery and muzzleloader, success, and I'm broadly speaking statewide, drops down into the mid single digits. And then when we move, for instance, to the concurrent rifle season, which is occurring during the deer and elk seasons, later in October, November, very low single digit success rates. Again, I don't have the residency difference on the tip of my tongue. The other point I guess I'd like to just quickly share is that the mass surveys that I quickly referenced with a couple sentences in my presentation are reports that we every year do around the state with our field staff out there collecting information on how food is looking for bears. And while it's not a one-to-one or a plug-in directly into a model, but we talk about at license recommendation and license setting discussions internally, we're viewing it through the lens of that habitat quality annually, which is what's so important for bears, as you alluded to. Their vulnerability goes up during those food failures, and success rates sometimes track that as well, going up.
Commissioner Garcia.
Thank you, Chair. Mark, just anecdotal. You know, the change, one thing I can tell you up in my area, Grant County, the change was confusing to people. And I want to thank the local staff, and I can just speak for my area. It was the education of getting people to understand the new system that made it work. So that was a huge part of the change.
Yes, thank you. And I guess for anyone who's listening, we still encourage folks that possess deer and elk licenses for archery and muzzleloader to buy the over-the-counter. We definitely saw a number of people that still purchased the limited license category for that new structure. They didn't have to. So thank you, and certainly thanks for all the folks from staff that are helping educate.
Thank you, Mark. I don't see any other questions with regards to Bear. So that, Katie Lander, I believe you're online, and we have public comment with regards to the quotas.
Yes, thank you, Chair McDaniel. I'm Katie Lanter, Policy and Planning Supervisor for Colorado Parks and Wildlife. We did have one member of the public sign up for comments on this item, so he will have 3 minutes to provide comments. I'll give a notice when there are 15 seconds left, and then let him know when time has elapsed. Hopefully he'll help me with the pronunciation of his name as we get him unmuted. This is Stephen Guerrieri. Stephen, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. And would you like your camera on?
Sure.
Okay. There you are. Go ahead.
Commissioner McDaniels, fellow commissioners, Director Prinsloo and Director Gibbs, I appreciate the opportunity to provide comment today. I'm a fourth-generation livestock producer and outfitter in the Gunnison Basin here, And I just wanted to comment a little bit about the proposed deer licenses in the basin here. I commend CPW staff. They do a wonderful job. The guys in Area 16 here in Gunnison are very proactive and very involved in our wildlife management, and I commend them. They do a wonderful job. But I do have some questions and some concerns. I'd sent a letter to all the commissioners. I don't know if you had an opportunity to read it. But my concerns are based on, you know, the amount of licenses that are proposed. We are over objective according to the model. But I think the number of licenses, doe licenses and buck licenses both, are just a little too extreme for what's actually on the landscape. The model tends to, right now our current model shows that we have a deer population that is at the same as what it was in 2007. If we look at what our aerial counts are every year, we tend to count the same amount of deer every year in these DAUs. So that's why I question our numbers and where they need to be moving forward. So I would encourage the commission to proceed with caution with the amount of licenses that are proposed. One of the most concerning things to me is the early seasons, the archery and the muzzle loading hunts. These are primitive weapon seasons where you have people that are, you know, trying to get extremely close to their prey in close quarters with these high numbers of licenses. It is creating unhealthy hunting habits for people in the field. I've witnessed a lot of unethical behavior amongst hunters just because, you know, non-residents wait as many as 12 to 14 years to draw some of these licenses. So we tend to keep putting more and more licenses on the landscape in an extremely limited hunt. But these guys are all congregated into certain areas. So it tends to not provide a quality experience, and it's putting a lot of undue pressure on the animals that time of year above timberline with the continued increase in recreation at high elevations. So I think we should have an actual reduction from what the 2020 licenses were, and not an increase, especially in the early season that was proposed. So I appreciate the opportunity to provide comment, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Any questions for Mr. Greer? Seeing none, thank you again. So that concludes the presentation and public comment period. So now we'll enter into commission deliberation and discussion. If any additional with regards to all the species quota recommendations. So any additional discussion with the commissioners with regards to these? Commissioner Garcia.
I'm sure, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were considering it unit by unit motion.
Yes, what I was going to see if, depending on the outcome of any discussion, and then was, which I can move to now, Commissioner Garcia, ask if there were going to be any commissioner recommendations by species that were differed from the recommendations of the staff. If there were going to be some, I would take those species. If there are not going to be any, I would then read forward a single motion for all. So I don't see any additional commissioner discussion with regards to the recommendations. So I asked this time, are there going to be any commissioner recommendations by species? So if not, I will move forward and read then the proposed recommendation. So is there a motion to adopt the proposed regulations and 2021 limited license recommendations for deer, elk, pronghorn, moose, and bear?
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Garcia. Second?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Haskett. All in favor of the proposed motion on the floor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion passes unanimously. That concludes item number 10. So let's move forward to item 11. We have Brad Henley, Southeast Deputy Regional Manager, to discuss public access program lease amendments. This is an action item. So, Brad, I'm not sure where you are. Oh, there you are. I see you now. Are you ready?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, Director Prinsloo, Executive Director Gibbs. My name is Brad Henley. I'm the Southeast Deputy Regional Manager. I oversee capital and access within the Southwest region and also manage the statewide public access program. So I'm before you today with a real estate proposal to add additional acreage to the public access program. And with your indulgence, real quick, I want to recognize several folks. I have a statement from the State Land Board that I'd like to read real quick to the commission. And I quote, adding public access to state trust land that is leased for other purposes, in particular agriculture, can be a challenge for our current lessees. The State Land Board would like to thank all CPW staff, in particular Brad Henley, myself, and all area and district wildlife managers involved in the process for taking the time to talk with our ag lessees, listen to their comments and concerns, and then create enrollment and access plans that address the issues that are shared. In addition, I would like to thank, this is the culmination of a monumental undertaking, as you all well know, to more than double the amount of acreage in the public access program available to our constituents. It takes a small army to get all of this done over the last 3 years. I would like to recognize the State Land Board, the district managers, Recreation Program Manager Abe Medina, and the State Land Board Assistant Director Greg Okus, along with the State Land Board Board of Land Commissioners in this effort. Along with that, our 18 area wildlife managers, the numerous assisted AWMs, area wildlife managers, our district wildlife managers, and the property technicians. That's where a lot of the work gets done on the ground, is at that level. And then to keep it all coordinated and get it out to the public, it takes a huge effort from our real estate staff and Kim Rogers and Courtney Wright. A lot of the coordination on the ground is with my PAP technician and Zach Speezy. Our GIS analyst, Chris Johnson and Robin Wilson, who do all of the GIS work, the development of maps, making sure all of these properties get into our hunting atlas, and then that data is shared outside of the agency in Onyx, so on and so forth. And, of course, Krista Heiner, because a lot of this is regulatory. I've probably given her another gray hair. Sorry, Krista. And then Chelsea Harlan, CPW's regulation brochure editor, who also puts together our state rec lands brochure. So I'd be remiss. I do manage the program, but I cannot do it alone. This has been huge, a huge undertaking. As Executive Director Gibbs and Director Prinsloo have already mentioned, the State Land Board did approve adding an additional acreage at their March board meeting. And I'm before you today to ask for approval on our third year of adding to the PAP approximately another 199,000 acres to the public access program. And I would be available to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Brian. Any questions with regards to the additional acreage being requested? See, and I have one for you, Brad. As you know, this is obviously a significant increase, doubling. But any feedback since we increased so much acreage before? How we're managing that? You know, are we getting any significant negative feedback from adjoining landowners, sports persons who are utilizing these new properties as to quality, that kind of thing? How we manage this moving forward since we're making such a big increase in monitoring this for the future?
Thank you for the question. Yes, and it's a good question. I would not consider significant negative feedback. There has been a lot of concern expressed with the expansion, particularly from the ag lessees on the state trust lands with the State Land Board. As I mentioned, each of those properties, when we enroll them or moving forward to enroll them, each property has an access plan. So we actually sat down with the ag lessee, the state land board, and our district wildlife manager, our AWM, whoever that might be, a property tech, and we worked through the best of our ability issues from surrounding landowners. A lot of these properties are not fenced, so trespass is always a concern. So we worked through those issues on signage, you know, where people can park, how they can access, and making sure that what we're providing to our constituents in the form of mapping and regulations address those concerns as well. So right now, I think we're in a good place. Obviously, this is culmination of a three-year effort, but by no means is this the end. As of still yet this year, we're still looking at additional properties to enroll. In future years, we are testing some properties that have big leases, ag lessees already on them to look at to make sure that the program is working before we add additional acreage that adjoins. So I hope I've answered your question. Again, there's always a lot of concern, but between CPW and the state land board, we have been very responsive to those concerns. The same questions arise from the land board commissioners as well. Through the state land board's website, we have upped our communication process whereby ag lessees can contact the state land board. They've made their website available to directly enter comments along with our concerns. And obviously, you know, contact on the phone, so on and so forth.
Thank you, Brad. Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Brad. What, one of the things, sort of building off what you just said, I'm interested in is, has there been conversations about doing habitat improvements on some of these properties? One thing to provide access, but, you know, got to hold the critters, too. It's something where there's just a myriad of restoration activities that benefit lessees as well as wildlife. So is that something that has been discussed so far as one of the things to move towards in this program in partnership with the state land board?
Yes, Commissioner Schaefer, another great question. I will remind the commission that part of our annual lease payment to the state land board for the public access program, the state land board sets aside what we call the enhancement fund to do enhancements, just what you were asking, on the properties that we're leasing. That fund also assists with any property damage that might occur from somebody who's accessed the property through the public access program. And I want to clarify, I've been in this program for almost 8 years. We've never had one claim of damage from somebody, one of our constituents, utilizing a public access program. So I do want to make that out there. But we have that set aside and available. To be honest, right now this has been such a huge effort to identify and evaluate the new acreage to roll into the program. I think that has been at our forefront of our efforts. But I have talked to several AWMs who are already thinking about improvements, habitat improvements to those properties. I do not know of anything that we have implemented as of today, but I know those discussions are ongoing. I believe that once we get the commission's approval today, we will order our signage and we will start actually working on the ground on all these additional acreage, the 199,000. To get those signs, and once we get past that effort, we're right into hunting season. Those will be available. All these properties will be available September 1 with your approval to our constituents. Once we get past that hunting season, or in conjunction, our field staff will start making those recommendations moving up for enhancements on the properties that we're leasing.
That sounds great. I think it's one where we've got there's a fair amount of buckets out there, things like the Restore program and others, where I think that, you know, this program's great, but it doesn't mean that it can't even be better. And I think that there's ways that we can, you know, enhance the hunting opportunities as well as the wildlife habitat conservation further on some of these properties. And so I'm glad that AWMs are thinking about it, and we can move towards that, hopefully after, you know, all of this yeoman effort of creating the access. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Schaefer. Commissioner May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred, one thing that's came up over the years to me, and I just wondered how you address it, is there a resolution to when you, say, have an inholding in privately deeded land, a state inholding within that, where there is no fenced boundary, actually no fence? The situations I refer to is maybe when a steel T-post is put out there to mark a boundary line, and a week later those T-posts are gone or broken over by cattle. How do you resolve conflicts in that situation? And is there anything new on the horizon that would prepare, such as a GPS apps that may make that more easily defined so that staff didn't have to continually resolve those conflicts?
Yes, Commissioner, and thank you. Another excellent question, and that is one of the issues that I referred to earlier that we do address. There's no simple answer. Obviously, what we strive to do is any of those private inholdings, we actually are moving towards Carsonite posts to mark those boundaries. We're doing that now, especially out in your country, sir, with Blue Lake and Timber Creek. We have a lot of inholdings there. That's one way that we address it. Our mapping, I was mentioning earlier that Chris and Robin in our GIS unit, they do identify through our GIS the private lands, or I should say we identify what's open to public access. Then that data is shared with multiple companies once a year to update. So when folks are out on the landscape with their Onyx maps through their phone or whatever that might be, we're trying to update that information. And as those issues arise, which has been in the past, it's been a data gap between Onyx and us. We've missed something. The annual invoice that I review to pay for our lease is 95 pages long. The legal descriptions are all the way down to tracts, lots, sections. So one simple keystroke can really throw us for a loop if the number gets off when we're doing our mapping. A second effort that we've implemented in the last couple of years, especially with the increase in the PAP and the walk-in, is those inholdings, we are asking those private landowners if they would be willing to enroll that property into our walk-in access program. That way, it's a seamless transition. They do get payment to have that open. So it works. That has worked very well in tandem with that, with our PAP and the walk-in access program. I wish I could say that we have everything fixed. We have every answers. Humans are just like wildlife. They don't tend to stay within their boundaries. So I believe our on-the-ground staff do address that. And we try to increase the information and have better information out in our brochure through our hunting atlas. And I hope that answers your question, Commissioner.
That's Brad, and I appreciate it. Sounds to me like you're very aware of the issues even before this, and sounds like those resolutions will be put in place. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner May. Commissioner Tuxton.
Thank you, Chair. Brad, I was wondering if you could comment, and you could just give me an average or if it's property by property, but what lease rate, say we pay for a lease to the state landlord for the hunting access,
versus what the agricultural leaseholder pays for the grazing access. I'm just curious what the differential rates are of who's paying what.
Commissioner, thank you for the question. I can answer partially. I am aware of what we pay for access, and please remember this is a limited lease. These properties, for the most part, we only lease from September 1 through the end of February, so it's not a year-round lease, so that does factor in to the lease rates between CPW and the State Land Board. Currently, well, you've seen it in the real estate proposal in front of you. Last year, we have two differentiations. We have walk-in and our standard rate. Walk-in is most of all the properties enrolled in the program east of I-25. The majority of the properties west of I-25 are at the standard rate. So I do not know what the lease rate, ag lease rate is, between the ag lessee and the State Land Board. And I'm not privy and I haven't asked. I can only assume that that is on a case by case basis.
Director Prinsloo.
I can add, I don't know exactly. I'm sure you have. There's commissioners can answer that too, but generally, so not generally, we pay by acre, and ag lease pays by animal unit month. And generally, the State Land Board is very close to private land leasing, not federal government leasing AUM. So that's generally between $10, $15 an AUM, animal unit month. And we pay by acre.
Thank you, Brad. Director Prinsloo, you also wanted to make an additional comment?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Brad. Thank you. Commissioner Schaefer's question, I really wanted to talk about Brad for a second, but I also add, and maybe it's a pride thing for me, but Commissioner Schaefer might remember that the Land Board bought HydroAx, and CPW pays to run and maintain HydroAx. We spend 50% of the time on our state wildlife areas and 50% of that time year-round on state trust lands for habitat improvement. So that's a wonderful joint project we have with our sister agency. So just want to highlight that. Last but not least, Brad was very gracious about talking about everybody that's involved in this. He's exactly right. What he's not telling you, he's really been a force to be reckoned with. You know, maybe I started it and Brett Ackerman cracked the whip, but you don't have to crack the whip very hard on Brad. At the end of the day, Brad is really a force to be reckoned with on this. He, to put it in context, the first 500,000 acres we put in state trust land took us 10 years. Now, that was part of the model, but it took us 10 years for 500,000 acres, and we put another 500,000 acres in less than three. And so a lot of that, not the on-the-ground work, but the work is really Mr. Henley. Brad is also, he's going to get mad at me, but he's going to retire at the end of June. We hope to see him in Trinidad. I would guess he's going to retire, so we won't have to keep doing this. He's never shirked a task. And so at the end of the day, I just want to say thanks to Brad. It's been a lot of work. Zach Speezy, too, who's the public access program coordinator out of Salida. This has just been a really, really heavy lift. So it's been a great wig of the governor's. You know, we've made a significant doubling impact to our constituents, and the payment goes to the school kids of Colorado through the State Land Board. So really is a win-win, and I just want to highlight Brad's effort in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Prinsloo. No other questions. This, again, I mentioned as an action item. It's a two-part one, so Krista Heiner will now talk, will speak about placing it in the regulation. One other comment, and that there were no public commenters who applied to speak with regard to this item, so we will not have that section before we enter commission deliberation and discussion. So that, Krista, are you available?
Yeah, I'm available. Can you all hear me again?
Can.
You can. Okay, great. I think we do have two separate motions, if I'm not mistaken, for agenda item 11A and 11B, but I can go ahead and do 11B right now as well. This is just, kind of a formality, adding these properties to Chapter W-9, the wildlife properties. This is step one of one. It's green in color. So as Brad mentioned, the public access program provides limited seasonal hunting and fishing opportunities on state trust land. And as part of a multi-year effort to double the size of the public access program, CPW is adding 58 additional properties with a total of approximately 199,000 acres to the program. And these property additions have been added to Appendix B2, which starts on page 2 in your materials. And these properties will be governed by the general provisions contained in Regulation Number 902. And that is all I have for you, Mr. Chairman, for that agenda item.
Thank you, Krista. Apparently, there is two separate motions with regards to it. I misread my schedule here. So I'm going to start with the first one on 11A. And again, there were no public comment for either item. So this is regard to what Mr. Henley spoke about, public access program lease amendments. So first, is there a motion to approve the modification in CPW's lease with the state land board as presented in the real estate proposal?
So moved. Second.
Commissioner Vardy, second. Commissioner Touchton. All in favor of the motion of report, please say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Hearing none, unanimously passed. That will move us forward then to, with regards to what Krista just presented, to place that into regulation. Is there a motion to adopt changes to Chapter W-9 related to adding properties to the State Trust Land Public Assets Program as proposed by staff?
So moved. Mr. Chair, I so moved.
Motion made by Commissioner May, second by Commissioner Vardy. Again, let's all in favor of the motion on the floor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. None, it passes unanimously. That takes us to lunch. A little behind, but let's keep to our schedule and reconvene at 1:15. With that, could you cease the recording, Dion?
So we're going May 7th.
Thank you, Dion. I'll call the May 5th Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission meeting back to order. We will continue on in our agenda with item number 13. Oh, I'm sorry, item number 12. Chris Steiner, our regulations manager, to discuss Chapter P7 with regards to passes, permits, and registration. And this is an action item. So with that, Krista, I'll give you the floor.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you mentioned, we're on agenda item 12, final regulations for Chapter P7, passes, permits, and registrations. And this is to update the requirements of the Centennial Pass to correspond with the requirements of other low-income passes and licenses offered by the division. This is step one of one, and you can find those regulatory changes on page 5 of the document that is orange in color. And these changes are mostly administrative in nature, but essentially what we're doing is updating the income requirements for the Centennial Annual Parks Pass to incorporate the most recent version of the income guidelines issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. These income requirements correspond to the requirements of other low-income licenses and passes offered by the division. You'll also notice that the address for the regulations manager has been updated to our new, my new 6060 Broadway location. Also, I'll just point out that previously there was a discrepancy between federal total annual income as specified in the regulations related to the Centennial Pass and federal taxable income, which is specified for the other low-income products the division offers. And so we've changed that in the requirement in the for the Centennial Pass to reflect federal taxable income to correspond with those other low-income licenses and passes and with the statutory definition of low-income senior. And so that is all I have for you, Mr. Chairman, for Agenda Item 12.
I'd like to open the floor for any questions for Krista. Seeing none, again, this is an action item, and
sorry, I have my hand in the air.
I see it, Darren. Hello, Commissioner Adams.
Hello. Thank you so much, Krista. I know we've chatted about this before. You know, I think it's absolutely incredible that, you know, these types of different pathways to access are available. And just, again, wanting to, curious if there has been any or if there already is any cross-agency or interagency collaboration as it relates to serving low-income communities that intersects, you know, health, education, and parks and wildlife as well. Because, you know, I'm just wondering how what we can do to reduce, you know, taking this opportunity to explore additional ways to reduce the bureaucratic barriers to accessing these passes that, you know, folks, you know, are qualified to receive. You know, so, you know, online and, you know, obviously the in-person barriers, and I know you're very much aware of those, but I'm just curious if these conversations are had. I think it would be helpful for the public to know that we are aware of these bureaucratic barriers to accessing these passes, and I think it would be great for them and us to know, you know, if there's any kind of cross-agency efforts to eliminate some of these access barriers and additional strategies that, like, you know, online or, you know, some kind of quick processing, right? We got those COVID payments very quickly. And so now I have a whole new, I know what's possible. And I would love to hear, and I'm sure others would. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Adams, for that question. Yeah, it's a good point. I'm not currently aware of any cross-agency efforts looking at these passes, but I could
not at these passes, but it's just any cross-agency efforts in working specifically with low-income communities in ways that agencies can support each other in paperwork and you know the you know paperwork burden, the administrative burden, as well as you know communication. Right? They you know sometimes health folks have more touch points than we do here at CPW. And so, again, wanting to also use these opportunities to make sure that everyone who has who are qualified actually has access, because access isn't access if you don't know about it. So would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that's something we could definitely look into working with our, you know, other agency partners.
Mm-hmm.
I can say, you know, we are definitely aware of kind of the bureaucratic hurdles that are involved in, you know, accessing many of these passes. And that's something that I think our licensing staff has thought a lot about, and we've thought a lot about on the regulatory side as well. Currently, we're limited by a statutory definition that of low-income senior, which we're hoping to change at some point, which will give us a little bit more flexibility in some of those requirements.
Right
now, I think our top priority is making sure that they're all consistent for, you know, customer ease and customer service. But your point is very well taken, and I think that's something that's definitely on our radar looking forward. So,
Again, I think it's one of those things where we want to combine our efforts, right? Because I know that we're not the only ones, right, with these issues around bureaucratic burden and barriers to access, right? I'm sure the health folks and the education folks and the workforce folks all have these same issues. And together, when we come together, we're much more powerful, right? And so, I appreciate your efforts. I'm happy to help out in any way, of course. And I completely understand that we're doing the best that we can under the conditions that we have. But we also have the agency to be able to continuously improve with the powers that we do have. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you again for your question.
Thank you, Krista. Phil Vilsack, I think you want to add some commentary with regards to that. You have your hand up?
Sure, just briefly, Commissioner Adams, how timely. I think we've just been discussing similar issues related to the Keep Colorado Wild Pass, and just wanted to point that out, that a lot of, I think the conversations around that pass have really kind of generated a similar dialogue and conversation around, you know, what communities, what organizations, like what other agencies within state government we should be reaching out to try to crack that nut and to make kind of the passes available for under-resourced communities accessible. And, you know, we're going to be having that conversation, I'm sure, even tomorrow with the Senate Agriculture Committee as we talk about how to do that. I've literally been kind of like looking at language from a couple of organizations even this afternoon about how we might streamline that process. And again, just make sure that we have communities and kind of organizations in the room representing under-resourced individuals as we make those decisions. I think there's a lot of different ways we can do it, and hopefully that pass will kind of start this conversation so we can correct this now.
Wonderful, wonderful. And, you know, again, you know, when I want us to also be mindful of the policy barriers and the access that we have and the agency we have to change those, right? We don't have access to change every policy, but someone does. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't remind folks that, you know, there was a time that it would have been illegal for us to even have this conversation, right? Illegal because of a variety of laws. And those laws were changed. So we are capable of a great many things. Let us act accordingly. Thank you so much.
Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug stole my suggestion, which is I think that advancing this dialogue is important. I think it's going to have to happen in the context of the Colorado Wild Pass. I also just want to point out that, you know, the guidelines that are redlined in the regs here, I've looked it up, and we're talking about some extreme taxable income here, $12,000 an individual and $4,000 and change for dependents. That is creating or alleviating barriers for folks that are struggling in an expensive state like Colorado is a good thing. So I think continuing this conversation is important for us to have so that we can try and, you know, allow as many stakeholders as possible to engage in our state's parks program and elsewhere. So I want to be sure to mention that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Schaefer. Other discussion with regards to this item? Again, it's an action item. No public comment requests were received. So we can move forward with the motion on this item. So I'd ask, is there a motion to adopt annual changes to Chapter W-5 as proposed by staff?
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Hauser, second by Commissioner Heston. All in favor of the motion on the floor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes unanimously. Crystal, I believe you still have the floor.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify, Mr. Chairman, I believe you might have said Chapter W-5, and hopefully our motion is not written incorrectly there, but I think we need a motion for Chapter P-7, actually, for agenda 12.
I did read it, and it was W-5 plus 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 W-5 plus